Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I want to call this meeting to order. It is number five of number six, and we're in the semifinal time now. This evening, we have a starting out Board of Elections, followed by Finance, Health Department, Mental Health, Rural Library, Youth Services, County Attorney, and the DA is making a return appearance because she couldn't be here the other evening. Joe, do you have anything you want to say starting out?
No.
I see all the people, or some of the people from Board of Elections, all the people from Board of Elections, and welcome, and you are on.
Thank you.
This coming year's budget is the one time in the four-year cycle where it is a significant increase in our budget. It's really driven by what's going to be going on next year. We have what is looking out to be two very large elections. The November presidential election is always very large, but next year being an open seat for the presidency, presidential primary is going to be a very large turnout. Last time in 2008, we had a 60% turnout in the Democratic Party and a 30% turnout in the Republican Party, which are both very high turnouts by any standards. And by the way, things are looking from the activity right now this year. Looks like the presidential primary is going to be just as interesting next year as it was in 08. There's also the potential for a couple of other primaries. In June of next year, there's going to be there could be a federal primary. You have the U.S. Senate seat from New York is up. If there's a primary for there, it will be a statewide primary, which will mean it's countywide here. And you could, if there's a chance of a possibility of a congressional primary also, which would then cause it to be a countywide primary here. And then in September, you have all your state and local races that might, there certainly will be a your state races next year, Assembly and State Senate, and there's possible there may be some local elections here, too, that you'd have a primary. But it's going to be a very active year, and probably in addition to that, we are taking over more and more of assisting the school districts throughout Tompkins County with their elections. Even though we don't run their elections, we do ballot preparation for them, and more school districts are indicating that they're interested in us helping them.
So like Steve was saying, we're in our four-year cycle, and next year is our big year, even though it feels like it's already started by the activity in our office. October 9th is the last day you can change your party for next year's primary, so we have a lot of walk-in activity and mail coming in. In this four-year cycle for the presidential year, this is the time that we have to ask for one-time money. And it's the only time in a four-year cycle that we've really asked for more help. And we have a pattern of doing this because we have found out we need the help. And it mostly reflects the one-time position is your senior voting machine technicians. Right now they're both at halftime. The other amount of money is we're asking for Target is just a slight increase in our data contract with national time sharing. That's all our voter registration data. This is the end of a five-year contract next year, and so the amount is only going up $1,600. And that's the only maintenance fee that we have to request for next year. That helps us with all our mandated reporting for the state as well. So they keep us on track in the DMV. We also have one other little position that's called our junior senior techs, and they also help us during this time next year, so we just need a little bit of money for them as well. And then we thought you'd find it interesting. We showed you a little election cycle for voter turnout so that you can see what we're talking about with the four-year cycle. As you can see, in presidential years, we go up quite a bit for turnout. And when we get back down to the local years, which we're in right now, it drops way down. So that's about it. It's just the normal request that we usually do at this time of year.
I neglected to say this at the beginning, and most of you probably found it already. It's in Chapter 4, page 20, the BOE budget page, and then they had number 3 and number 4 OTRs. One was for $16.95, and the other is $124. And Joe one time funded that, and the other was included. So any questions for Board of Elections, please raise your hand. Mike and Mike. Go ahead, Mike.
Just a question.
Yes.
Mike, you need your microphone.
I will re-ask the question because of that. So do the school districts kick us any money because of that?
Yes. Okay. The city of Ithaca kicks in the most. It comes in about $8,000. And then the other school districts are quite smaller. So this year we included Trumansburg. And next year, Lansing and Newfield have already expressed interest. And what we do is
Dryden too.
Dryden. Oh, so yeah. We're going to have three more. So we're pretty much having year-round elections now, especially next year. We'll be just getting done with an election and preparing for the next one.
Joe, does that count towards our consolidation of resources or whatever? It sounds like it should.
So. It probably would. Yeah.
Okay. And my other question is, do the towns kick us any money, or is this just part of our responsibility to the towns?
Yes. If you look at the revenues, the towns do have, we have a chargeback. Most of our stuff is not charged back, but where you see the $92,000, that's mostly the chargeback on the ballots from all the towns.
Mike Klein.
We have two special elections, oddly enough, this year for the county legislature. Which, because of the charter, fall at the general election time, and I wondered if that has caused anything. Is it better, worse, more expensive, less expensive? How the process is working? I realize it's still early.
Well, certainly from a budgetary standpoint, it helps that we can run these two elections in the general election, because it doesn't add any cost to the process. Your time frame for your ballot nominations is, for party nominations, it's 4 days longer than if you'd done it at another point of the year. Your nominating petitions for independent nominating, it's just a little bit longer, but not. It's still too short by some people's measures, but we're at that time of the year where we got to mail out our absentee ballots this Friday. So we're for the general election, and so we're running up against the wall already. So it creates a little bit of work, extra work in our office, but I think we're handling it fine.
Our office is very thankful, because if you start having another election right after election, you still have just one portion, just the machines, is 108 steps to get ready to have another election. So we're very thankful with the timing.
Thanks.
Martha Robertson.
Hi. I've started hearing stories, news stories, about places where they have electronic voting machines. I know our scanners are electronic, but, the touch screen machines kind of being out of date and needing to be replaced and all. How are we on, how's our equipment? Is it?
I would say it's very good. We have had a couple of machines where we, through our testing process, have found that, batteries have burned out, that we have to replace the batteries. But there's nothing where we've had a failure to work out in the field. I guess we had two or three years ago that we had to replace in the field. But by and large, I think they're holding up very well.
Okay, great. Another reason the optical scanners were the right choice. If the state were to, let me ask about early voting. We can't do anything locally about early voting. Is that right? We just follow the state's calendar?
That's my understanding, yes.
There was a proposal, I want to say a couple of years ago, about early voting that I think it passed the Assembly, but not the Senate. And I think it required something like all polling places to be open for 2 weeks ahead or something like that. I assume you'll remember better than I do. Is there, do you remember that proposal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how far it made it. I think it did. I'm not sure if there were several bills, and I'm not sure which bill ended up coming out of the House or out of the State Assembly. But it was a one-house bill, if it was a bill at all. I'm not sure even if it made it out of the Assembly.
Okay.
But,
if there were to be some kind of a modified proposal, I mean, to balance the cost on one hand versus the accessibility of being able to vote, maybe you can't answer this right now, and I'd be happy to hear from you later about, like, what do you think would be a reasonable proposal in terms of cost, say, if, like, three polling places and just a few weekends ahead of time, or is there anything that you two have talked about or that you kind of have on the shelf?
Well, the issue you run into with the original proposal, which was getting a lot of noise, which was the one where you have to keep a polling place open for each of, I think it was 14 days up until the election day. The problem with that is there's very few facilities that I think could be able to furnish you their facility to use for each of 14 days up until election day. And I think they wanted 10, I forget, it was 5 or 10 within a county, but for a county of our size, that would be hard to find the sites, I think, that you could do that with, because you have the accessibility issue to deal with.
Do you think it would be possible, say, to have, you know, a machine available downtown in your office, and then, say, one on the east side and one on the west side, something like that?
Well, I mean, you know, we could certainly do whatever the state mandates. It will add to the budget. I haven't run the numbers. I don't know if you've run the numbers recently. I know at one point you did.
I haven't run any numbers recently, but the other problem is the staffing. From now until Election Day, everyone we've appointed, like on my side, I lose like 30% of my workers. So we have to train over 400. And to actually have them, it was the hours were too long, too, remember? It was,
yeah.
The hours were like 10 hours a day. So there needed to be a lot of revamping on that. But if we wanted early voting, we wanted something more that in line in our office, because we're central there anyway, and it would have worked a lot better there.
Okay. All right. Great. Thanks very much.
Peter Stein.
Quick question. Early voting is not strange in the United States. I think most states have it. So what do they do? Do they keep all their polling places open around the clock, so to speak, for a month? Or I know that there are some places that let you vote anytime early.
Really? Well,
do you know what they?
I'm not totally familiar with all of the. I know that a lot of states do have provisions for early voting. I'm not familiar with exactly how extensive the early voting hours are. But you know, this is New York, has to go through the Assembly, the Senate, and the governor before. You know, we'll have it here. It's not something that we can do ourselves.
That's not strange. I mean, that must be the case every place that it's enshrined in the law. Might be interesting to look and see how they do it, actually.
I think that would be for the Assemblywoman and the Senator, frankly. Is there any other question? Thank you both very much. Up next is
Thank you.
Finance Department, Chapter 4, page 111. And there are 5 OTRs and 22 through 26. And Rick is now, he has a better seat than he had before. And whenever you're ready.
We'd like to bring to you the Finance Department budget. Thank you for your attention and your time tonight. I'd also like to introduce my two division managers that are with us this evening. We have Helen Beach here this evening from the Treasury side of the House, and we have Sharon Reagan from the Comptroller's Office, which we now call the Accounting Office. And they're both my two lead people, and I thought I'd bring them along because they can usually answer the questions that I cannot.
That's a sign of a good manager, but go ahead.
In looking at tonight's and next year's budget tonight, we're looking at some substantial increases, which the last 2 years I was able to sit before you and say there's no OTRs, the level of funding is exactly the same. In fact, it actually went down in those 2 years. But what we're looking at tonight, although it may seem a little high to start with, there are some factors that we're building into the budget that will create for us a sustainability plan, because we have quite a lot of turnover coming up in this next year. And I thought I'd address it the best I could by improving our revenues, improving our expenditures, and really taking out a pencil and really sharpening it up this year to show you what we need. For the expenditure side of it, there's a dollar change of $221,000 or 19%. We'll be looking at the OTRs in a minute so I can break that down for you. The revenues, unfortunately, are declining to the tune of almost $27,000 or a negative 7%. Altogether, the net local portion, unfortunately, is climbing $248,000 or nearly 32%. Some of the highlights I thought I'd bring to you in a narrative that shows what makes up these big changes for the finance department for next year. What are the initiatives that we're involved in, and what are the drivers that support this budget? Number one, we're going to pursue the electronic processing of contracts through eGov. Last year, we purchased a module that allowed us to centralize and to make electronic all our bidding. So as we work through the purchasing department and we put bids out and we receive bids in, that has been a successful accomplishment for this past year in the purchasing division by using this eGov software. What we'd like to do in the upcoming year is to use that same software and begin to process all of our contracts through that. We've actually started to use it, but it's not completely rolled out because we need to provide access to the system, not just to the purchasing division and not just to the contract division and administration, but we need to provide access to it to all the members of the finance department and to quite a few different departments. So this has been a streamlining process, and it saved us a lot of labor dollars because, of course, we've been looking in the past of adding people either into contracts or into the purchasing division, but this seems to have alleviated that concern, and we think we can keep going with the same number of staff with this new and nice software product that we now have in our possession. It does not represent any new purchasing dollars because the software has already been bought. We just need to move further down the goal line, or further down towards the goal line, to get all the contracts processed through this system. The second one is an item that we've been working on for a number of years with ITS, and that's continuing rolling out the Time Force electronic timesheet input. As you are aware, ITS and the finance department together are bringing this to the various county departments, just one department at a time. My first year here, I believe it was that very first week I was here, they had just rolled it out to the finance department and to the administration department. And over the last 2 years, they've rolled it out to various other departments. Number three, we're looking to interview and hire three candidates to replace current employees that retire in 2016. All of the large numbers that you see that we're asking for tonight in the budget have to do with positions. The positions that as we have right now, we basically run an 11-person shop, and it's quite a small number when you think of all the services that we provide and how large the county is. My previous position, I had 21 people working, and that was for a city of the size of 19,000 people. So working with 11 people is really working with the fewest number of people that I think that we could successfully run a department with. But what we're looking at doing this next year is to begin a sustainability program that will cover those main positions that we'll be losing in the next 17 months. When I say 17 months, I'm counting the three positions that we're going to be replacing next year due all to retirements, and two positions in the next year. So when you add that all together, I'm losing five people out of 11. So it's a pretty big jump. It's going to be a very brand new team by the time we're all the way at the end of this. But what's very fortunate is I have managers and I have employees working right now that are helping to build up the process so that when we do bring these new employees online, most of them are willing and able to stay here for 2 or 3 months to help train the new position, the new people in these new positions. And that's part of what drives this budget, is that we have some duplicity or overlap in some of these positions for that time period when the new people are being brought on board. When I say that we're losing five people over the next 17 months, I also have to add that these are my five top people. These are the people on the top end of the scale in the finance department. It starts with my division managers, and then it's our head payroll person, Linda Halstead, and it's also our head auditor, who also works as an accountant, Donna Shaw, and she's the second in command under Sharon Reagan. So I bring it to you so that you know that the five top people in the finance department that are immediately under the finance director are going to be retiring. Number four is to provide training sessions for county departments on the proper procedures for purchasing accounts payable, fixed assets, and budget adjustments. This is a repeat of something we had in there for last year. There's an ongoing program that we need to continue to bolster so that we get better tools out there to all the other departments. Kevin's been a big hand in helping me bring to the departments the better ways to submit and do their budget adjustments, being that he and I together work hand-in-hand with budgets all throughout the year, not just during this time when the budget is being passed, but during the whole year. It allows us to be able to rethink some of our budget transfer and budget adjustment processes. But we need to do a better job in bringing this training out and rolling it out to the departments. Number five, prepare a training guide of job duties with detailed explanations of all aspects of jobs in preparation for the staff retirements. We're in the midst of this right now. Many of those who are exiting and leaving their jobs here with the county are enlisted to help update these procedures, and we want to make sure that we have very good manuals and training guides so that when we bring the new people online, that they're able to have at least that tool to help them learn their new job. And number six, continue the collaboration with planning, visitors bureau, Airbnb, private homes, et cetera, to get places registered for the room tax program. There have been a number of people both on this legislature and in the planning department and other departments and citizens too that have helped us in this effort about adding to that programming and helping to get more and more people registered for paying the room tax. We've seen the revenues go up as a result of this, but there still needs to be more of a collaborative effort. Helen Beach and her department in Treasury there are handling a lot of these meetings, meeting with Tom Knipe and going to some of the planning meetings. And I appreciate all the oversight that that members of the legislature here have given to really move us forward so that we really do begin to capture more revenue from these places like Airbed and Breakfast. So these are some, not all, of the initiatives for the next year. And I wanted to turn next to the number on the roster. As I said, there's been an 11-person team in the whole finance department altogether for the last many years. This next year, there is one change. In addition to all the staff changes through retirements and attrition, we are asking for one new position, and that's represented in an OTR, which I'll reveal here in a moment. But basically, that one new position, after quite a few different meetings with Joe on this effort, we decided that it would be my best help to hire a deputy finance director. And the department has not had one of those for many, many years. There was a deputy controller at one time, so there was a position in effect many years ago. But I think this will help in this new team-building approach, where there's got to be a little bit of relief on my shoulders, because there are times during the year where there are multiple projects that I'm involved in, and many times there aren't staff that are acquainted with those particular projects well enough to be able to run with them. And so I put into the budget a deputy director of finance. Joe's approved it. We've talked about other ways around this, but we felt that because of the transition time that we're going through, this was probably the best time to ask for and request this particular position. And now we'll look at the OTRs one at a time. I'm going to refer to my booklet here because I have some notes written in. But if you want to refer into your guide, these start on page 111, section 4. And the first OTR is a little bit difficult to understand because we're asking for an increase of $24,500 due to a decrease in other revenues. And this you may not be familiar with from looking at a whole lot of other departments' budgets. Usually you see revenues increasing, but part of the problem in the budget that I've experienced in our finance budget the past 2 years is that each year when it comes time to do rollover, I get to do the rollover calculations, and Kevin gets to email them all out to the department heads, letting them know how much they have from rollover funds from 1 year to the next. Each year that I've been here so far, finance has managed to get a negative rollover, which means we don't get any. And I've always been hard-pressed to try to explain why so many of the departments have rollover monies that are available, and, of course, some do not. But I was hard-pressed to find why is the finance department not able to generate rollover funds. It's not because we don't look at our expenditures very closely, because we do a very adequate job as far as making sure we do our budget transfers and we cover all the funds that we need in the expenditure line. So it's not that we're overspending. So what else could it be? When I finally had a chance to look at it, there had been revenue increases in each of the preceding years, and they were just inflated on an arbitrary basis, 4 or 5%. And so the revenues grew at a higher rate than what we were actually recording or actually seeing. So I wanted to, this helps me in two ways. This helps me in bringing a budget to the legislature which more accurately predicts the revenues that we are going to receive. You'll see that some of the local revenues and other governmental revenues, other source revenues that finance receives, is actually projected to be lower for next year. And that, in turn, has the effect of driving up the amount that we need to go to the legislature and ask for an increase in our target. So that's what that first OTR represents, a $24,000 increase to increase our target because of declining revenues. And you still may be thinking, how does this affect your rollover? Well, when departments are granted their rollover from the previous year, they don't get that just because they've stayed within their budget, in their expenditure budget. That is part of the rollover calculation. The other rollover calculation is how well did they do with their revenues? And if their revenues came in greater than what they budgeted, they have that more money to add to their rollover. So some of the departments don't even do the revenue projections. We do that for them. Or some departments just put the same amount, and that they're rewarded. Department heads are rewarded not just for expenditure savings, but they're rewarded if they're how their revenues come in. And in most cases, they don't even have control over what the revenues that come in are. In some cases they do, but in other cases they do not. So I saw that that was having a detrimental effect on our budget year after year after year, that our budgeted revenues were too high. So I thought I'd bring this down to a more realistic and practical scope, but needing to have to bring this to your attention and ask this of the legislature with our first rollover request. The second rollover request addresses the support and the overlap of outgoing and incoming employees. Out of those five possible retirements, three of them are taking place next year, and the fourth one is for a position that very well move up to take the place of one of those positions. So what we've drawn together in our overtime request number 23, again, that's on page 111, is the number of positions that are going to be vacated during the year, and then for each of those, we've built in overlap for a new person coming in. That overlap is 6 weeks or six payrolls. Excuse me, it's six payrolls or 3 months. So that provides for a training period of 3 months for each of these positions as one goes out and someone new comes in. Why do I think this is a good approach? And I was very encouraged that Joe supported it too right off the bat, is because when I came on board and worked here as finance director, I had somebody here to mentor me. I had somebody here that the legislature had the insight to be able to train, because they knew that the job was very encompassing and multifaceted. And so Dave Squires was willing to stay here and work for those for that 90-day period to help provide a basic training platform for the new director of finance, me. And I am very thankful for that. I don't see how that could have really happened any other way. And I'm dealing now with losing three of my top people, and I don't really see, and all of those positions, by the way, are what you would call, are they called sole incumbencies? Is that what the term is? Sole incumbencies, meaning there's no other people in their job classification. They are, in effect, the only one. We only have one payroll supervisor, and we only have one auditor, and we only have one director of accounting services. So these are very important positions that I'm hoping and praying that we will be able to fill with this funding attached to it. It's unlike all the other OTRs in that this is just one-time funding. Once we get past this period, the funding will not be requested in other years, because, of course, this is just a one-time event. But the others, as we get to those next, those are monies that will recur in each and every year. The next one is OTR number 24. This one has to do with our service contracts. And this $26,500 is made up of two components. There's two major software systems that we need to budget more money for. And the first one was a $12,000. It was that bids and quotes and contract module that I referred to right off the bat tonight. And it's a $12,000 ongoing annual maintenance cost, of which Kevin and I had decided that's going to be split in half, so that finance, actually the purchasing division, will pick up half of that cost, or $6,000, and the contracts division in the administrative department will pick up the other half. So out of that $26,500 software cost that we need, $6,000 is for that new contract module. The other $20,500 is for an increase in our SunGuard Penimation product. We went through an upgrade about a year ago, and this is the additional amount that we have to pay each and every year going forward for the new Penimation Plus, which is a product from SunGuard. We should be with this product for a good number of years, but it's a $20,500 cost, again, target funding that really is unavoidable. The fourth OTR, which is number 25, as found on page 112, this represents a projected increase in auditor's fees. It is not yet decided that this is the exact amount of the increase. The contract for auditing services has just concluded, and I'm going to be bringing to the budgeting committee and later to the full legislature a request, after Joe and I have discussed the exact dollar amount, for what we feel we need to increase the budget on an annual basis for auditing services. The contract has concluded, and I would like to recommend strongly that we extend that contract for a two-year period. 2 years would help us get through this long and drawn-out employee transitional framework that I put together for retiring and exiting employees. I would not like to see us change auditors during this process, mainly because not only would we be losing a lot of historical and corporate knowledge with losing key employees, as I know is going to happen, but I would also be losing a lot of important and historical knowledge by changing auditors at this point. So I've already met with the auditors a number of times. We've just wrapped up the finishing touches of last year's financial statements. I met with the auditors, and they said they would be willing to do that. We'd have to draw up a contract, and I'm willing to bring that to Joe to help work out the details, and we'll eventually bring that to the budget committee and to the entire legislature. But I thought I would let you know up front that normally we would have been starting on an RFP for auditing services probably around August or September, and now I would like to bring to your attention that I'm going to be recommending that we extend that contract. When I look at what we've been paying the auditors over the last few years, their contract hasn't been increased for a six-year period, and they let me know right off the bat that they were going to have to increase that somewhat. I knew it would be in this $20,000 range. Last year, at the end of the year, they ended up writing off a little over $19,000 worth of billings because they went over, and I just did not have the budget to pay for it. So it's not a signed, sealed, delivered deal. It's just an idea at this point. But I
look forward to seeing it.
And the last OTR, number 26, has to do with the new deputy director of finance position. And we've thought about this, and Joe's brought this to my attention, that maybe there would be a way before we put this in the budget that we could somehow restructure staff, and maybe we could build a health insurance consortium a little bit more, because one of our employees, Lisa Christian, who works about 50% of the time on health insurance consortium business, actually, after looking at the time spent on that business, she's actually working about 75% of her time on health insurance consortium business. I spent a lot of time on health insurance meetings and their audit and a lot of extra work, but none of my time gets charged to the consortium. So I think that there is an area where we can explore where we may be able to bill the health insurance consortium a bit more for the time that's spent doing consortium work. But Joe's recommendation at first, or at least an idea that he had, was why don't we just stop doing the consortium's books? Why don't we just pull out and not do that? And I thought, well, that would save a lot of time, but there's so many efficiencies, I believe, that are built in to us for our finance department doing both the county's books and the health insurance consortium's books that I don't think anybody else could do it as efficiently, as inexpensively as what we do for them. And you have to remember that in the end product, we are part of the consortium, and I wear, it's one of the many hats that I wear. And I thought after at least listening to that suggestion, I would go back, and I even wrote in the effect if not funded for this the new position that I believe that it would be make the most sense that we would look to another alternative rather than trying to do less work. I would try to bring on a new person, a new body, that would be able to help me with this particular function. They could, a new director of finance would, along with many, many other duties, would help provide some relief for doing a part of the consortium work. What I most need with this position is somebody to help me when we're working on 3 and 4 projects at a time. What you're most familiar with is we go through a long year-end close and the associated audit. While I'm working on that year-end audit, I almost always have to be working on a new bond or band note issuance in July. So those are overlapping. Doing the work on the bond debt in the spring and trying to close our books and audit our books and do our financial reports are happening right at the same time. And I felt if I had another person who could handle one of those while I'm working on the other would really improve the turnaround and probably give us even more expertise going forward. And some of the other things that come up at the same time is just the audits themselves. There's 4 audits that I have to work on each and every spring, and it's the TCIDA audit, the TASC audit, which is the Tobacco Asset Securitization Collateralization Corporation, that audit, and the health insurance consortium's audit, and then finally the county audit. So I'm working on 4 audits at the same time. And what I hate to say is that one of the things that gets pushed off to the very end is the county audit. I have to take care of the smaller audits first because they're on a quicker schedule. And so sometimes I don't even really get to work on the county audit, although we have staff members that are working on it until much later, into sometimes as late as May. So we're feeling that with this extra person, we could begin to delegate the audits so that those 4 audits aren't on the shoulders of just one person. And there's other things I'd like to see this new person too. As the administrator of estates, I'm working on 3 estates of deceased people right now. And sometimes you could have as many as 5 or 6 at one time. And it's an astounding amount of work to have to work sometimes on nights and weekends to close out these estates and to clean out people's apartments and get people to do so and to auction their goods. And I didn't realize that that was part of the function of a finance director or a treasurer for the county. But that's another hat that I have to wear also is handling all the estates. And this would allow me to delegate some of that work to a person. There are other duties that I really look forward to having an assistant or having a deputy, such as allowing them to work more on the fixed assets of the county. There are certain positions that as they come and go over the next 17 months, I would think that this person would be able to fill in and help work as those people who are new are coming up to speed. And so that person might be able to revolve around and help fill in a particular office at a time when they need it most. So that's pretty much my justification for this position. The amount there, the target salary, although it hasn't been graded and it has not been officially signed off on by personnel, the salary is $74,800. That amount there represents the amount that includes fringes, and it also includes about $4,000 for computers, desk, furniture, things of that nature. And I think that's all the OTRs.
Rick, that is a really extensive, very good presentation in terms of not only talking about the OTRs, but specifically about the last one. Many people around this table, since I've been here and even before me, have always said, gee, there's another person needed in the finance department, and I am glad to see that finally in this request. Anyone have any questions? Martha, Mike, Julie, Carol. Can we be crisp for the questions, okay?
Yeah, thank you, Rick. On priority one, on the revenues, I don't know what your revenues are. I mean, most departments, the revenues are maybe grants that they get or, health department fees, you know, but, so there are estimates involved. But I see you got treasurer's fees. Aside from collecting all the taxes, which I know you don't get to keep, what are your fees?
Oh, help me here. Tax searches.
And is there any?
We do tax searches. We get revenue from providing copies of things like that.
Please come to a microphone, and it'll make it a lot better for all of us. Thank you.
We get fees off bail when we close them out. Court and trust accounts, we get fees. We have fees for foreclosure, fees for advertising delinquent taxes, fees for NSF charges.
Is there any abandoned property?
Get certain fees off abandoned property when we send that to the state. Tax searches are the biggest one we have. So that, depending on the market, they go up and down. So that sometimes they'll take a dive if there's not a lot of searches to be done for properties. A lot of copies. People don't need copies. They can get a lot of things now online, different places. So that cuts into our income because they're looking at other places. So it's just a combination of a lot of different fees that go up and down depending on the public and the different programs and as they go up.
Are you saying that they've been, for a few years now, that line has been overestimated in the budget compared to the actual?
Yeah, a few years ago it took a dive when the market went bad. So we were getting a lot of searches, people doing a lot of searches on properties. And then it took sort of a dive, and we had a couple big court and trust accounts that we got money off of. Those have gone down. So it's something that goes up and down, so we try to keep it consistent, never knowing what the next year is going to bring.
Okay, that's very helpful. And on number four, on the audits, I know the IDA pays you to do the audits, or I think they cover the audit fees.
The IDA pays for their own, yes.
But library and soil and water do not?
Library and stormwater do not.
Okay.
Martha, it would be out of one pocket or the other.
I guess that's fair. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
I think I had Mike and then Carol and Dooley. You too?
Rick, on your number 23 there, the overlap money. Mm-hmm. Typically, how long of an overlap are you talking for a position?
Six payrolls or 3 months.
3 months. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Dooley, go ahead. And then Carol.
So is purchasing will still be a one-person operation?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And why is that?
Mostly because of that short dissertation I gave in the beginning, how we bought that new contract module. And that the contract module has now, we've now gone to electronic bids going out and bids coming in, and it saved a great effort. And
so there's much less research required. In fact, there's no time to do any research, it sounds like. You just leave it to whoever looks it online?
Well, we actually have, that person now has more time to do increasing research when research is needed.
Mm-hmm. Appendix A has your fees listed, Martha.
Thank you.
Yes. What happens in other counties to settle estates?
It usually falls to the treasurer. I'm part of a treasurer's group, so the only training that I've had in it at all has come from that group that I belong to. So in the state law requires that somebody, this should be somebody's job. There should be a public administrator of a state, and when there is not that job somewhere in the county framework, anywhere in the county framework, it falls onto the shoulders of the CFO, the chief financial officer of the county, and our particular instance, director of finance. Most places, it's the treasurer.
So we're a charter county. We could say who should do it. Is that something that we should talk about in the charter committee, Mike?
I don't know how many estates they deal with in a year that you would become involved with.
Since I've been here, it's been about seven. Dave Squires is still handling the last two that he was handling, and they're almost closed out. These sometimes go on for 2 and 3 years until they're finally closed. I'm working on one right now. Well, just to give you the range, I'm working on one right now where the estate is probably going to be $500,000. So there's a lot of work involved with selling the property, stocks and bonds, and a lot of intricate things that I often have to go to an attorney for help with. There's another one where a gentleman died with $14 in his wallet, and that was it, and everything in between. But in every case, I have to marshal all the assets and sell them and bring them to Lori Decker over at the circuit's court, and she's been a big help in leading me through the process. And so you could typically have about two or three at any given time that you're working on, but you could have as few as zero, and you could have as many as six or seven all at once. But right now I'm working on, it's either three or four that take up a lot of time.
It's not clear to me if that's the best use of your time or not, so I'm puzzled by all that. Thank you.
Carol and Peter.
Yeah, Martha and Dooley asked a bunch of mine, but it had to do with these fees, but two others. So does the health insurance consortium pay a fee for us to handle their audit? And on the estates, is there any progressivity built into that? Is there an estate below which we don't charge, and or a higher percentage charge for estates that are larger?
Well, I haven't been through any estates where we've generated any income yet. So there,
you charge a fee?
No, we don't charge anything, and I don't get anything from it. Some counties are set up where the treasurer reaps the benefit and gets to keep a certain percentage of what's given. Here in Tompkins County, the finance director doesn't receive anything for handling the estates. What I understand is when we close out and handle a large one, there is a fee schedule in the New York code that allows the county to recoup for its administrative services a portion of that estate. So I'm looking forward to finally closing one out so I can see what, if anything, the county gets to keep. So that would be revenue that would come into the finance department, but we haven't seen any yet. But that answers the fees for the public administrator. And the other question on all our other fees,
you answered the others, but the health consortium.
Oh, the health insurance consortium. We do get paid, and it's for 50% of one employee's time, and we may be able to increase that to 75% of one employee's time. But their audit is totally paid for on their own. They have their own audit, and they pay for their own audit. So that's not part of our cost. My time, yes, and working on it is great, and there's no way out of that. As long as I'm also the treasurer of the consortium, that comes with a heavy lift.
So where does it show up in the budget then? That the income from these kinds of things?
It shows up in Division 1315. Which is the comptroller's division or accounting division, and it's part of the comptroller's fees, I believe, is where it goes.
Thank you.
Peter Stein
is under.
Yeah, about this estates. Reading the Ithaca Journal every morning, there's like three or four dead people that died. That's $2,000 a year. So you don't do that, right? I mean,
thank God, no.
What are the?
These are people that die, and there's no living relatives, nobody left.
Okay, thank you.
And they typically don't have a will, and they're just folks that there's no one else that could possibly do it.
Thank you.
Let me just say, anybody interested, David Squire still has that thing he's trying to do, and he's got a really great supply of VHS tapes if anyone wants to drop by his house, and he will sell you those. And the guy with $14, I hope we didn't take any of his money. At any rate, thank you very much, Rick. That was extensive. Up next is the Health Department, Frank Krupa. He's in Chapter 4, page 129, OTRs 27, 28, and 29. And,
Oh, sugar. Did I break something? Okay. All right. Thank you, sir. Okay, good evening, everyone.
Good evening, Frank.
Oh, it's the elevator. I don't touch that. This. Want to talk about our health department budget for 2016. So the recommended budget from the county administrator, as you see it here, there is a change, a pretty significant change in the net local impact, and we're going to talk in more detail. That is the majority of that is mandate in children with special care needs, and we'll talk about that in some good detail for you. So the major influences in our budget this year, as I just mentioned, our children with special care needs program consists of two different programs, early intervention, which is children from 0 to 3, and then pre-K, which is children 3 to 5. And what we have seen over the last few years is there's been a lot of structural change in these programs, from how we get reimbursed to how much we have to pay out up front, to the number of children and the intensity of the services that are provided to those children. So we'll talk a little bit about each of those components. So in early intervention, our budget, historically, we paid the full cost, and then we chased after insurance and or state aid related to the programming. And in 2013, the state took over the fiscal administration of that process. You probably remember me here complaining about how smoothly that was going, and it still continues to be a challenge for us. But what has happened is now the relationship exists where insurance and Medicaid are billed first, and then the state takes out of an escrow account the portion that the county owes. So when you look at our budgeted amount, the actual total appropriations this year is significantly lower, but is still an increase, a small increase in the local share associated with that, and that is because we don't pay out the full amount. There are payments made first, and then we reimburse the state. So that's the early intervention and kind of where that process is. The other side of the equation is the cases in early intervention have been growing significantly. So since 2009, we had about 400 children in the program, and in 2014, we finished with 560. So that's a pretty significant increase, and we've worked hard to make sure that we identify and get children into services that need them. In comparison, our preschool numbers have remained pretty steady, and that's fairly unique in New York. In most counties, the pre-K program has more children than the early intervention program, and I think that is a testament to the efforts that we make to identify those children and provide them services as soon as we can, because the earlier we get to the children, the more likely they are to have successful outcomes and not need continued services going forward. But what that means is our caseloads have grown fairly significantly for the nurses that do our early intervention service coordination. And you probably remember that we came before you 2 years ago, I think now, to increase the hours of all of our nurses, trying to increase capacity without actually adding more people. To try to address that issue of caseloads. You will see in an OTR tonight that we believe we're now at the point where we need to start considering adding another case care coordinator, and I'll talk about why we think that when we get to the OTR. So that's early intervention. Our pre-K program is where the net local increase, the bulk of it, has come from, and there's a couple of issues related to that. One is the rates went up. In 2014, we actually saw some retroactive rate increases, so we got hit with a big number that we weren't planning for, which made it a little more difficult for us to kind of think through what those rate impacts were going to be for the continuing years. So you'll actually notice that for the budget that we submitted to Joe back in March for consideration of the mandate accounts, is pretty much right at where we think we're going to end up this year. And it was about a $350,000 to $400,000 increase. So they came a little early. Some of that is our estimation of the rate increase and what those impacts are going to be. The other component to this is while the number of children has remained fairly consistent, the intensity of those children has grown, meaning the amount of services that any one child might need has gone up. So with the rate increases and the need for additional services, that's what drives up the program costs. And while we're talking about that, one of the things that we've done recently to deal with the caseloads in early intervention is we assign children to our senior community health nurse. So we have a division director. And then we have a senior community health nurse that generally provides some leadership for the program to support the division director and support the nurses that are providing care coordination. Because of the caseload levels, we had to assign children to that person. And generally, the role of that person, besides supporting the nurses, is to be a part of the pre-K teams that evaluate the children and decide what services are being provided. So it's been a struggle for us to have a presence at all of the different school districts for all of the different meetings to evaluate the children and decide what services are provided. And I would point out that in pre-K, we don't make those decisions. It's the school districts, and we are just one of many people at the table, but certainly our voice carries weight. And because of that caseload on the senior community health nurse, it's made it increasingly difficult for that voice to be a part of the discussion. So that will speak to the OTR request as well. We do have to pay. So while we're not making the decisions, we are mandated to pay for those services and for the children in both programs. So that's children with special care needs and kind of where we are. The other thing I have up here is state aid uncertainty. And it's not a bad thing for us right now. Our state aid with Brenda's work and her team has actually increased a little bit. And that's a good thing. But where the problem lies is that over the last few years, the state has reduced the things that we are able to include as eligible costs for state aid, so call them disallowances. So there were traditional optional services, things like the medical examiner, early intervention administration, other things that at one point we would get state aid on, but over time those have been reduced, the things that we're allowed to claim. And essentially it's gotten down to just the core public health services will they reimburse us for. So essentially what they've said is if we as a county decide there's a particular public health need that needs to be addressed that's outside of core public health, the state's not going to help. It's up to us to pay for that. And so that's a concern. And I was actually in Albany this morning meeting with governor's office staff and the budget and ways and means committee's staff to talk about a potential increase statewide to our base state aid grant, as well as the percentage over that base grant that we receive. So right now we receive $650,000 of 100% funding. So we bill to the state for eligible costs, and up until we hit $650,000, they reimburse 100% of that, excluding fringe costs and indirect and some other things that they don't pay for. Once we get over that $650,000, then we get 36%, so 36 cents on a dollar. The county supports the rest. We are asking them to increase that base grant to $750,000 and the percentage from 36 to 38. As we understand it, that percentage hasn't been raised in over two decades. So we feel like if they're going to disallow those optional services, we need more base funding to make sure the public health infrastructure can be secured so we're available to respond to things like Legionnaire's disease, Ebola, and these other emerging issues, as well as participate in governor initiatives like the District Project and Medicaid reform. So that is state aid uncertainty. Our FTEs are fairly stable. The 0.3 change, some of it has to do with the infamous WIC positions that have come through to increase those hours, as well as some small changes we've made with a couple of information aid positions. We have a front desk person that was hired in as an information aide and has worked to educate himself to be able to perform environmental health work. And so in the spirit of that information aid position and programming, we've created an opportunity for him to continue doing that environmental health work as he continues his education, at which point he should be able to achieve a bachelor's degree and then be eligible to be a sanitarian. So in doing that, we had to bring somebody on to fill the information 8 hours that he was now no longer occupying while he was being an environmental health technician. And so that's where those small pieces come from, those three areas. Our over-target requests, the first two are in the recommended budget from Joe. And these are related to our health and safety program. So as you're aware, the county's health and safety program, which is responsible for the health and safety of all 700 county employees, lives at the health department. And the person that had been doing that for over 20 years retired this year. And we have, in the tight budget times, that budget got, because it's completely county funded, got trimmed very, very lean to where we were essentially just paying for the person. And so we know we needed to look at building that back up, and that's where the target for funding the health and safety program dollars go to. Some of it is a slight increase in the hours for the position. The rest of it is related to travel, supplies, and other budgetary operational items that we need. The second one is for software for the safety data sheets. Those are they used to be called material safety data sheets, but have since changed. And they are for the chemicals that we could potentially be exposed to as employees, toner cartridges for us here in the room here today, but certainly facilities, highways, airport, those kind of folks you can imagine are exposed to, are potentially exposed to a lot of different chemicals, and we are required to have those safety data sheets available. We created, our former health and safety coordinator created a very rudimentary online system that is essentially thousands and thousands of PDFs that were pulled from the internet and put into a single place. ITS is not happy with us with that system. And so they suggested we look at a vendor that could potentially provide that service for us. And we have looked at one vendor. We believe they could do the job. We would, of course, need to bid it. But we think the dollar amount that you see here will allow us to have an online safety data sheet system that would just require us to identify what needs to be in our library. And then as we acquire new products, let the company know, and they will add those to our library. And then at that point, those data sheets would be available to anyone with internet access. So those are the two funded. The one that's not recommended is the community health nurse within the Children with Special Care Needs Program. And again, this goes back to the things I've spoke about earlier. We have seen caseloads go up. We've tried to build capacity within the people that we had there. We've shifted children into our senior community health nurse position to make those caseloads as reasonable as we could, but that has taken away our ability to have that senior community health nurse doing the work that position should be. And so at this point, we are requesting to be able to add a community health nurse to that program, and the costs you see here are related to salary and fringe.
Questions for Frank? I have Martha and Mike so far. Go ahead.
Hi, Frank. On the first OTR, you got $5,000 target for travel and training for that person.
Correct. So in the past, our health and safety person was OSHA certified, and it is a week-long or a two-week-long training that would require travel outside of New York State to obtain, and there were other things such as being able to do hearing screenings as well as fit testing for masks that our previous employee was able to do, and we would need a new employee to be able to do that. We're not sure at the salary that we're proposing that we would be able to find somebody that already has those skills.
But that every year? That's target. That $5,000 plus $3,950 professional services. What's that one? This target also.
The professional services is also related to potentially some things that are being done, like the hearing test. We have someone that we pay to do. If we find a problem with the screen, we have to pay them to. We have to pay an audiologist to see the person and read those results more specifically. So we were looking at, there are components that we might train the person to do, and then there are components that we might outsource in a more effective manner. So we were trying to make sure that we had enough to cover the wide range of services that were being done by the previous employee. Ergonomic assessments are another one where there was a grant that was funding those, and we were essentially getting them for free. And anyone that requested an ergonomic assessment would get one, and we would have somebody come in. Now it will cost us $140 an hour, roughly, to have somebody come in and do that because the grant went away, and we would have to pay for that to happen.
Okay. How many hours has this position been, and what's it going to?
Is it 35 to 40.
All right. I'm just kind of really surprised at that number for one person as a target item. I understand when somebody comes in, may have training up front, but that seems like a big number for one person. All right, thanks.
Mike.
I'm just wondering, on the last OTR, how much of that is fringe and how much is pay?
Salary is 61,304 and fringe is 33,165.
Anyone else? Carol. Mike. Carol, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. The state funding that you were talking about, having been in Albany this morning, that they cover the first 600 and some odd thousand dollars at one level at 100% and then above that. Is that based on anything? Is that based on the population of our county or just history? Or
no, it's mostly history. I will tell you that there is a population base. So for any county that's a million or above, so New York City and Suffolk and Nassau, they get 65 cents per capita. And so that was just kind of an arbitrary place at a million people where they would get more. Per capita, those counties get significantly less than a smaller county getting 650,000. And we are actually advocating to double that per capita rate from 65 cents to $1.30.
So we're not close to the some population limit?
No, okay. We're not, no. Okay. It would just add Erie, Monroe, and Westchester to the population counties.
Okay, and then on this third OTR, I don't know, make that come alive a little bit more in terms of early intervention, why we're seeing the numbers going up, and whether there's more juggling you could do from other positions that are maybe seeing a decrease.
So the program itself, our children with special care needs, is basically staffed. We have administrative staff to do the financial side, but essentially is staffed by service coordinators, which are all nurses. There's five continuing service coordinators, two initial, and then the senior community health nurse that was added into that. And essentially, our nurses were carrying caseloads of 60-plus children in order to meet it. Some of it had to do with vacancies that we had that we have since filled. As I said, we did increase hours trying to build capacity within the existing people that were at the department. And ultimately, in order to get the caseloads to a more reasonable number, and reasonable still arguable, down in the 45 to 55 range, we've had to assign children to what normally is a leadership position within in the program. And so that person is now seeing a caseload worth of children and not able to do those leadership functions as I was describing, specifically attending all of the support plans for the children in the schools and the pre-K program, which, as we said, we don't have a deciding factor on how many services are going to be provided, but certainly being at the table allows us to provide our expertise in helping those that do make the final decision apply what we think are appropriate for the children. And we do have to pay those costs either way.
Peter and then Mike. Yeah,
5, 6, 7. My question was answered.
Michael.
Legionnaires' disease, the new state mandate for registration of cooling towers and inspection. Have you got capacity in your department to do that? Do you have funding to be able to do that? What's happening there?
So I'll start with the funding question. There is no funding associated with that new requirement. The state would argue that they give us state aid, so they're giving 36 cents on a dollar if we're above. As far as resources, there are emerging issues all the time. Legionnaires is the most recent. We were dealing with Ebola before that, and many others in between that don't make the newspaper. And that's part of what we look at from creating that foundation and that infrastructure piece with state aid and county support, of course. It's impossible for us to plan for all of the things we don't know, but now that we do know that this cooling tower situation is going to be something ongoing, we're working with the state to try to fully understand what their expectations of us are. At this point, we're really a resource for anyone that identifies that they have a cooling tower and then does the screening tests. If they have issues, they can certainly reach out to us and we will coordinate with the state. So we do that and we do that on a regular basis on things that don't make the media, but it is certainly an added responsibility that we now have that does not have a funding source directly related to it.
Anyone else? Last question, Dooley, go ahead.
This is a trivial question relatively. The Environmental Health Division, do they only examine wells upon complaint?
They only examine wells upon Correct. We do not have a well permitting program. We do, of course, deal with small water systems. So if there are multiple connections to a system, we would permit those and certainly would be involved. But for my house, with a single family home with a well in the back, there was an attempt to put a well permitting program in place prior to me being employed here that was not successful. So we do not have a well permitting program.
Are you in favor of establishing such a program?
Absolutely, as is our Environmental Health Division.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you very much, Frank. Okay. Thank you both. Mental health, you're here for that one, I presume. Mental health is Chapter 4, page 205. There are three OTRs, 44, 45, and 46 with mental health.
Stay on that. Thank you. And I, of course, forgot to introduce Brenda Crosby, our public health administrator, I think you all know. And now Betsy Doling, the fiscal administrator for the mental health department, joins me.
Thank you, Brenda.
Yep. Okay, so on to mental health department. Oh, let me stop touching things. So here is the recommended budget. A very small change overall in the net local in the mental health department. So wanted to talk a little bit about what we do over there in the mental health clinic because it does drive a lot of our LGU or local government unit related expenses. So we've done over the up until August of this year 1,023 unduplicated adults, 566 with SPMI is significant persistent mental illness, so there's no P, so just significant mental illness, I'm learning. Forensics are those related to the legal system, 200, children and their families, 350, and elderly, 92, which brings us to 2,231 unduplicated clients served through August of this year. Our continuing day treatment program, it has 65 unduplicated individuals. You have probably heard talk of PROS, which is a new program that will be transitioning the continuing day treatment program from, and so we're hoping that that will occur in 2016. And then we also have our health homes care coordination, which used to be our just case coordination at the mental health department. With the advent of health homes, we expanded to serve all of the needs of the clients in our care coordination. So we have 297 unduplicated individuals there. However, some of those 297 may also receive other services at the mental health department, but they're unduplicated within the health homes. So that gives us 2,593 total altogether, and that's where the bulk of the clinic dollars at mental health go to serve those almost 2,600 people. Current initiatives that we have going on that will be either beginning, finishing, or hopefully not taking all of 2016, but we are in the process of implementing a new electronic health record system. This is a joint project with the public health department. The original hope was that both departments would be going live on October 1st, which is a couple days from now. Unfortunately, as has been the case with many electronic health record implementations, as we found out, those deadlines are not hard deadlines. So in an effort to move the project forward in what we thought would be a more successful manner, we put the mental health component on hold in an effort to try to meet the October 1st go-live date at Public Health, mainly because mental health has a current system that they're using that we're replacing. Public Health does not. And so October 1st is a deadline for many reasons related to billing, coding changes, and other and other efforts that we need to see completed. So we have worked and made significant progress. We are not going to meet October 1st, but we do believe that we are weeks away, not months or years away, which is a significant improvement. And we believe we'll be able to either continue billing with what we have and or we'll be up and running soon enough that we won't be past deadlines to submit the billing. So I switched back to public health there for a second. I'm sorry. But the mental health project will kick off again in earnest as soon as we are live with public health. And I will say that both the ITS department as well as the project lead for mental health have been in an everyday capacity working with the public health system, one, to learn from the implementation issues that we have, and two, to make sure that as we're looking to share the system, we don't move forward with public health components that could potentially impact how mental health might also use the system. So we wanted to maintain that voice, and that relationship has gone very well. And we are all excited to see what the potential lies in the future for us sharing that same database. Meaningful use is a component of EHRs, so there's a federal program to provide funding to make sure you're using your electronic health record to its fullest capacity, and it's a stepwise product process. In the beginning, there are funds for each prescriber that you have if you meet certain goals, and we're working on year two, of that process, and ultimately there will be Medicaid and Medicare penalties if you are not meeting meaningful use with your EHR. So we are ahead of the game, I would say, in most instances related to that, but it is some significant changes, especially as we're transitioning to a new EHR. So staff are working hard with that, and that also needed to start October 1st and will. Oh, that's true. So what Betsy just reminded me is that the funds that we received for meeting previous requirements with meaningful use have funded the new EHR. So those dollars that came in, we set aside and are using to put in our new electronic health record. Construction on the first floor to consolidate reception and support services. Really what this came out of was security. So there's been a lot of discussion about the security of the mental health building. I'm acutely aware that there's not a single locked door between Green Street and the commissioner's office. So, you know, as soon as I arrived, it was clear what everyone had been talking about, that certainly the commissioner's office is just one place in the building, but everyone needed to be more secure. And so out of that, we've been able to put together this project that will create a centralized reception on the first floor. That has gone out to bid. It went out to bid on Friday. So hopefully that will be coming to you all in about 4 to 5 weeks for the approval so we can begin construction on that. We're excited for two reasons. It's going to create the much needed security, but we also have ongoing initiatives to try to use that new space more effectively, both to provide an open and welcoming environment for our clients to come into, as well as for us to streamline processes to get people into and checked in and up where they need to be in the building effectively, and limiting those folks that don't have a reason to be in the building from traveling freely. I put in here, actually, Betsy did, about the Smart Work project, because we did want to thank the county for their continued support of those Smart Work projects, because it did help us evaluate how we do our reception. As you can imagine, right now we have it broken up onto 6 different floors, and we're talking about putting a locked door on the first floor. So that's a pretty significant change in how we do business, and the Smart Work process was kind of the first step of trying to map out how we might do that change, and there are continued efforts that continue to build upon the work of that Smart Work project. I talked about PROS, the personal recovery-oriented services. We have submitted to the state our application and are waiting for them to give us the final go-ahead to start that. So our continuing day treatment program will transition. We're currently recruiting for a program director for the PROS program, so we hope to have that person on board soon. And we fully expect the state will approve our application. We did send it to the regional office a few times for feedback before we submitted it. But everyone is patiently waiting to get that started. We're all very excited to make that transition. In our Health Homes program, children and youth are going to be added to Health Homes. They've been at the beginning of the year. Currently, we're just doing adults. So that's a big transition for us. And this is actually an opportunity where our Health Homes coordinator is working with our director of children with special care needs at the health department to see if there's a way where, as we bring children on, might the 0 to 5 children have their health home be at the health department with the children with special care needs staff, and then transition back down to the mental health homes folks once they hit 6 years old. So we think we have expertise that we might be able to bring to bear on that issue, and it's really exciting to see those programs working together. The Vital Access Program, because we are a vital access provider, we have applied for funding to help us become more efficient in bringing people into our clinic and providing effective services to them while capturing as much billable income as we can. If we're successful with that, that program comes with funding for 3 positions that we would put into our clinic to help us with our open access initiatives, as well as looking at measures to improve our outcomes. And that brings us to open access and intake and assessment. That continues. You can come to our building Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and we do our best to get people seen that day. That was a change that was implemented a couple of years ago, and it has been fairly well received, but it is difficult to do, as you can imagine, to be just available for anyone that wants to walk in. So we're still working the kinks out, and we really do believe that the Vital Access program will help us get a leg up on that issue moving forward if we're successful. Otherwise, we'll do it on our own. Full-time equivalents, similar to public health, small changes. My notes, Betsy. Oh, and this was related to the PROS. So we felt it was important that we get a PROS program director on board to get us ready to get up and running. And so we had a retirement of an art therapy position, and we used that funding and some other to bring it from a 0.7 to a 1.0 to be able to recruit for that PROS program director ahead of getting the approval from the state. So that was the increase that you see there. Over-target requests are all one time. The first two that are recommended are related to moving our technology forward. We have 2 units, our forensic unit and our children and youth team, that work in the field, and we want them to be able to have access to the records that they need in a more accessible fashion than what we're currently using, which in most cases are a desktop and a pad of paper and a pencil. The third one is partially funded, and this is related to vehicles. Joe has been talking about needing to update our fleet, and so we gave him the 9 vehicles. I think our cutoff was if they were 9 years or older, they got put on the list, and Joe has recommended funding 5 of them, which are the 5 oldest in our fleet. I believe that's it.
Questions for Frank? Anyone? Martha?
It seems like this department has a lot of jargon, and I'm afraid. Could you describe health homes and what does that mean?
Sure. A health home is an amped up form of managed care. So essentially the person, the high end user, so you have to be a Medicaid user and you have to meet certain requirements. And once you do, you're assigned to a health home. And then that health home essentially provides a case manager that gets you connected with all of the services that you might need. What's unique is that it is at the mental health department, but we're responsible for all of their needs, not just mental health needs. So that was the big change when that came.
So like if somebody also needs Medicaid application or HEAP or Section 8, any of those kinds of services?
Yep.
Okay.
The three areas are that they either have a mental illness, a chronic condition, or a substance abuse issue. So those are, and the Department of Health, are they're feeding us those clients.
So this health home program is a DOH program. It's not an OMH, OASIS, or OPWDD program.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And well, that sounds like a good thing. And then the you mentioned the electronic health records that public health and mental health are going to have a joint database. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. We were both looking to, so the health department was looking because of the closure of the CHA, the system that we had with home care based, and we kind of hobbled it together for the other parts that we did. So we were looking for a public health system. At the same time, mental health was looking to upgrade from the current system we have, and public health was ahead of where mental health was. And in talking with Sue Romanchek, we decided to hold off to see where they got to in mental health, to see if we could increase our buying power, because we would have two departments and it would be a unique opportunity for a vendor to have a public health and mental health county departments in their system that they could then sell and those kind of things. So all of that came into the negotiations with the vendor, and we selected what we think is a very good electronic health record. And ultimately, through discussions with Sue and then with me taking on both roles, the decision was made that we could get into a singular system, and that initially we will be partitions, probably too strong a word, but we will be only accessible to our own programs and that nature. But we wanted to be able to have the potential as things progress, as we think they're going to, where primary care and physical health needs to be integrated with behavioral health, that we would have the capability within our EHR to strengthen the bonds between the programs and the two departments. So it's kind of some forward thinking, knowing we're going to have this electronic health record for a decade plus.
So let me jump ahead and see if this is something that's possible. So in other words, there's one intake process. It's the same way you use the database, and you just have, at some point, you're going to code people, mental health or physical health. Or it seems like 10 years ago or something, there was a big push about youth services and how to, and it came out that one of the barriers for people getting county services, and this sort of came through youth, but it might have been any of the departments, that there are so many different places and different systems, and every time you walk into one of our offices, you start all over again with intake. And it's like, so staff in every one of our offices is sitting down taking the same information with slight adjustments when you get deeper into the application, but there's so much stuff that's up front the same. And there was conversation about, you know, a countywide database, basically, of anybody seeking and using benefit services. Is this the kind of thing that could be possible? And would that, I mean, in order, like, to also include Office for the Aging and Youth and Social Services?
I think that's still the dream, Martha. I don't think we're there yet. Even with this process, part of the challenge that we're facing is, you know, mental health has always been very protective, as they should be, of the confidentiality of their clients. And the idea that someone at public health even knows they're in the system means if they're not a public health client, the only other place using our system is mental health. We've had a lot of discussions about that, and to be quite honest, it's going to be some culture change for us to accept that that's reasonable and acceptable. The state, both OMH and OASIS, have been supportive, knowing that this is the direction we're trying to go, specifically with DSRIP and integration of behavioral and physical health. So we're hopeful that over time those barriers that have been in place, and they are mostly in place for confidentiality, reality will start to fall away as people begin to accept that their information is going to be shared with other providers in order to better help them. And I think the regional health information organizations, where when you go to your doctor now, they often are asking you to sign off a consent to have your records sent to those regional health information organizations so all of your providers can access your chart. People are starting to experience in that and feel it and know that that's where we're heading. So as you know, the public and those accessing services begin to feel more comfortable with it, those of us in the professions begin to loosen up a little bit what's been hammered into our head for all these years about confidentiality, to recognize that it's in order to best serve that person, we have to see everything that they're dealing with. Because if you have a mental health issue, but you also have diabetes, if we're not trying to address both of those simultaneously, chances are one is going to fall apart if the other isn't addressed. And so it only seems to make logical sense, but it's a culture change that it's going to take time. This particular EHR, I don't think it has the capability to bring in youth services or necessarily link with DSS, but I think it's the first step in heading towards that ultimate goal.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Frank, I want to ask a question, not about the budget particularly, but I'm looking at two budgets that add up to roughly $23 million. You have been operating in a dual role over some time, and I would like to hear how you feel about that, what your response, what are you thinking about in terms of how that's working out for you and both departments, and how do you see it moving forward?
So I think everyone's aware that the county administrator has been evaluating this and has put out a report. I certainly support everything that was in that report. When I first started this, Joe asked me, should we just do this now? And I said, absolutely not. It doesn't make sense. Things are very different. And while I understand that substance abuse and mental health issues are certainly a public health concern, I didn't quite see the direct connection. But now, having been in it for 7+ months now, I have no doubt that this is the direction that we need to go in. I think whether it's me or somebody else, the idea of having that high-level view into what both departments are doing is invaluable. Just the thing we mentioned with the health homes, the Children with Special Care Needs program, and the potential that exists for a partnership there is going to solve so many problems that each department would have been trying to figure out on their own. And I'd like to think that if there were two department heads, we still would have discovered that over time, but I can tell you it immediately was visible to me, being responsible for both. So I just think that potential exists in a lot of areas. There's a lot of catch-up that I would need to do, or anyone in this role, making sure that they understand the full scope of what both departments need to accomplish, and that the attention is applied effectively to both. I'm learning mental health. There's a lot of things that, we can – there's a lot of good things going on there, but there's a lot of potential opportunities for improvement as well, that I think the expertise and experience from the physical public health side of things around collaboration, working together as a community to address issues, as well as the prevention and education methods that we do every day, can absolutely be a benefit to the mental health department. And I think from the public health side, we've identified mental health, promoting mental health and preventing substance abuse as a public health priority, and being able to call on the expertise of 65 people that are working in the same county government with us that are experts in those areas to help move those initiatives forward, I think the potential is astronomical. So there will certainly be challenges. It will not be successful immediately. There's going to be bumps in the road if this is the direction we go. But I think the potentials far outweigh those challenges that we're going to have to overcome.
I have Will, and then Peter, and back to you, Martha. And Julie.
Why don't people go first? I'm still I'm trying to understand, make sense of what Frank just said. So, Peter, why don't you go, and I'll take that.
I just had a simple question about the putting together the data of the parent, the client, the client records together, the two departments. Does that mean that if I said to you, how many mental health patients do we have? You say, I couldn't answer that question because it's just one big file. I can tell you how many. Is that correct or incorrect?
No, that's incorrect. People would be assigned to a program as they're entered into the system, and we would be able to run report by program. So the same level of detail I provided you tonight with unduplicated clients, we would still be able to provide that same detail.
Okay, thank you.
Dooley.
So the joining together of personal information, I think I heard you refer to local doctors who ask when you go, will you okay this to go into a shared database? And you don't have to do that. And in fact, if you're serious about wanting your personal information not to be easily hacked, you don't do that. You specify which doctor you would like your information shared with, and it just goes to them. So it's not a foregone conclusion that everybody's going to just say, yes, hooray.
Absolutely.
The business of how you're looking forward to continuing to work in both departments, I did finally just today finish reading Joe's manifesto, and I read somewhere that you don't have required certification. So my question is just, are you going to seek that certification yourself?
So right now, in a little over 3 years, I would be completely qualified for the position. What I lack is 4 total years of experience leading a mental health, substance abuse, or developmental disability clinic. And so I would eventually meet that requirement.
So it would be just de facto. You've been there that long, so it's okay.
Yeah, because I have a master's in public administration. I'm required to have the years of experience, and I don't. And that's the issue. We're still talking to the state to kind of understand that, because it runs contrary to several executive office initiatives, from shared service type scenarios to the Medicaid reform and trying to integrate behavioral and physical health. So it seems like there should be some flexibility. But if not, the medical director is currently serving as the DCS, which is what requires that. And that is really the role that the state has concern about the qualifications for. Certainly,
what is DCS?
I'm sorry, Director of Community Services. So typically the Commissioner of Mental Health also serves as the Director of Community Services. It's that specific role, the DCS, that requires a certification. As the state initially put it to me, they don't care who runs the department. They only are concerned about the DCS being competent to make the decisions that need to be made. And there's validity to that, because we can hospitalize people, we can take rights away, we can assign other people that can do that. Those are all things that somebody with clinical expertise should be involved in that decision-making process. So there are options for how we might handle that. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
Back to you, Will.
Thanks, Jim. And thanks, Frank, for your long day. If you weren't already this morning having to do 2 of these reports, you're doing remarkably well.
Thank you.
I can appreciate the challenge you've faced moving into the dual role, because to my mind, they're very, very different entities, even though they share the word health. My sense, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that public health is regulatory. It is dealing with institutions and, you know, restaurants or whatever, wells. It is public health education. It is, as you said, sort of trying to evaluate services that are needed and delivered for pre-K, but you don't actually deliver those. Those are done by the through the schools or the pre-K Head Start. Whereas mental health is much more about actually direct service delivery with clients. Is that an accurate distinction?
I think partially. So probably 60 of the 65 employees over at the mental health department are involved in direct service, whether it be clinical or health homes. There's a large component of the mental health role, the local government unit, which is responsible for the overall mental health, substance abuse, and developmental disabilities communities. And that includes signing off on state dollars that are passed through to those organizations. It includes creating a priority plan with the community services board about what is important to the community so those dollars can be aligned. It's making sure if there are gaps in the services that we need that we're working to improve that within our community. So similar to how the health department has very specific roles in environmental health or immunizations, or even children with special care needs, there is also the responsibility of bringing together our community, identifying what our health issues and concerns are, and figuring out ways we as a community can address those. So I think in that manner, they are similar. I think the amount of So most of the employees at the health department are involved in that direct service of some type, and you can describe it how you want. I would argue that our nurses and CSCN are care coordinators. They may not be doing nursing necessarily like you would normally imagine it, but they're still providing service. So it's a very similar model in that most of the staff provide a direct service, but the department as a whole has a responsibility for the entire community beyond just the services that we provide. And I think our community health improvement plan just is a prime example. When we went through that process, a public health process, we identified promoting mental health and preventing substance abuse as one of two public health priorities for our community. And so it was incumbent upon us as a public health entity to understand better what was the mental health and substance abuse communities were facing, and that process had already begun. I will tell you that that process is now light years ahead of where it would have been if we had continued to just try to learn it from the periphery. Now having a single person that can see the full scope of both of the areas, while I'm not promising miracles or that things are going to change tomorrow, but over time, being able to have that singular high-level view is going to provide significant benefit in moving forward our goals.
Well, I certainly can understand the virtues of trying to have both departments have very close communication. Whether it truly takes one person to be directing that is, I think, remains to be seen. My second question has to do with the PROS program. Am I right that this is a renaming and reconceptualizing of what used to be called day treatment?
Correct.
How is it different?
Well, that is a good question. So the idea with PROS is it's personalizing what we're trying to do for the client. So it's going to move from what now is very clinical-based to a more well-rounded approach for the individual. So the goals are to get the person back to work, into education, or into volunteering, something that, you know, from a standpoint of what is it they want to achieve as a personal goal. So that will move beyond just providing them clinical services. We'll be looking at vocational educators. We'll be looking to team with partners in the community that can help us provide different types of skill building and other trainings, as well as the clinical component still being a part of it. But it is a shift from a purely clinical type. Come in during the day, we're going to have groups, we're going to have art therapy, we're going to do those things, to let's talk about what it is your goals are as an individual and how we can help you achieve those, both through clinical services as well as other wraparound services that we either provide ourselves or can work with our community partners to provide.
And is it time limit? Is it the premise that somebody will be in and out, or can it go indefinitely?
It can go indefinitely. The goal is to help people achieve their potential, whatever it is they work in hand with their service providers to identify. We want people to get better. We want people to reach their potential whenever possible. And I think that's the focus more so than just a place for people to come. It is about getting them to a point where they can do what it is they've identified as their personal goals related to recovery, treatment, being a part of the community, whatever that looks like for the individual.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Seeing no one, thank you so much for both reports, Frank.
Sure.
Up next, rural libraries. And they are Chapter 5, page 40. They have one OTR, number 53. You're on.
Alrighty. I'd like to thank all of you for inviting us here to speak with you this evening. You know who we are. We're in your neighborhoods. You know that we are the buildings, the resources, the people that attract newcomers to the community. We are the community centers. We are the gateway to technology and to resources and learning. What we provide is services for everyone, and you can see from the many lists that are going to be on the following slides that that encompasses literacy, story times, job seeking, taxes, language classes, books and e-books. The list is long. I'm not going to read all of that to you, but what I would like to say is that we mirror your mission. Our work is your work. We strengthen families. We enhance the quality of life. We respect and protect the freedom and expression of privacy. And we are building community. We are supporting learning in all of these ways. With story time, we start with babies. We have book discussions up through seniors. We don't just have resources. We will make available resources for what jobs people need to know about. We will help them build their resumes. We will have the access for them to apply. We have the state-of-the-art technology. We don't just have books. We circulate tablets and laptops and e-readers, and we teach people how to use them. Homework support is in the library. It is 24/7. If you go to our website, you can click on a service that will take you to a librarian 24/7. There are language classes in the library, and there are language resources so that you can learn Japanese at home with your library card through Mango Languages. There's lifelong learning support, and we train you, we teach you, we have the resources. Our community meeting space serves Girl Scouts, robotics, school boards. Anything that happens in a community happens in the library. Good and bad. And we also have interlibrary loan, meaning that we share resources with each other, and we have world libraries at our fingertips. We build community. We collaborate with each other, and we are also employers. We train people on how to have a job. We have three people working at the Chermansburg Library right now. That started out as in the youth worker program. We have one who became a circulation assistant after graduation. We have one who became a librarian, and we have one in school who is becoming a librarian, and she currently runs our summer reading program. Those are the kinds of things that we're out in the community making those connections and finding out what we need, and we also do this with each other from all the libraries. So you're going to hear me talk more and more about that we are a hub, that we engage the community, and that we're there to learn and support each other. Again, these are just more examples of the things that we're doing in every single one of our libraries for everyone. There are no barriers. And I did mention that we were the gateway to the digital world. 45% of Americans rely on their public library for computer access. I know that we are all using technology. Imagine if you had to do it in an hour a day. 44% of people who are low income, that is the only access that they have. And now tax forms, you have the library is the only place to get them. They're not mailed to you. You have to go to the library. I can tell you we do not get funding to support that. We were all printing and going online and finding the right forms and helping people and providing tech support classes. And we also don't have the time for that, but we'll talk more about that. And we have the tech, we introduce the technology. People don't, there's an assumption that we're all connected. We're not. The library connects them. We have technology petting zoos. We have the devices that you can borrow. We are there to train you. And then we have to have the staff who know how to do that. And it gets more and more challenging every year. We also know that people use the accesses to computer and social media for that social connection. And there are many, many people who are being left out of the conversation. If it weren't for libraries, they couldn't even get online. So some of the new technology that we're talking about puts strains on our budgets, but it also puts strains on our ability to constantly retrain ourselves, train the staff to provide those services, and it is just so far an ever-rising trajectory because every year there's something new. If you look at Windows 8, I don't know how many of you went from Windows 8, didn't know how to do it, went to Windows 10, and now are back because you forgot because you figured out Windows 8. And we not only have e-books, but we have e-magazines. We have to tell people how to use the books and magazines onto their phone, not just, you know, one device. There's probably in this room, there's probably 20 devices that people are using. Their favorite. So we do what we've always done. We recommend, we evaluate, and we are still finding that now we also have to teach you and even have the resources available. And the other thing is it doesn't stop with a laptop or the computer access. We also have the gaming world, and there's sometimes a misconception that gaming is just the Minecraft or the Super Mario Creator or those types of Nintendo, perhaps, games, but we're all gamers, and in our society, we've been connecting through games and sports and playing all the time, and libraries have to keep up with this. Our library has a Wednesday afternoon gaming, Dungeons and Dragons. We have kids who play Magic. We've had mini golf in the stacks. So, again, these are just more ways that we create, collaborate, and connect, and we do it in ways that most people can't even imagine because you have your own ideas about libraries, which we'll get to in another slide or so. You can see these slides show that we have Lego programs. We have, there's some kids playing games, and we also have the early literacy and imagination. This is not something that is unusual. We're all doing this everywhere. And so I have already said that we build communities. We are what makes a possible and informed and literate citizenry. This is democracy. Every single one of us believes that at our core, or we wouldn't be in our job, because I can tell you it's not for the money. We enrich, we expand, we enhance the life of for people in our communities. You'll see that there's students there reading to a dog. Many of us have this program. They do that not just because it's fun, but because they build fluency. They can really learn to understand what they're reading and comprehend, and they can do it in a non-threatening way. We're out there providing that support for them to use their real skills. And you'll see that these are from many of our libraries, and if you look at the number of people in the programs, if you look at the breadth of experience, it really begins to tell you how important libraries are to each of our communities. And this is from my library in Shermansburg. We received a makerspace grant, and we had students building computers called BristleBots and making flashlights out of mint tins. Like many other libraries who are doing the same, it's just giving these students a chance to put those skills into practice. They also are learning skills that you may have thought they weren't so interested in. They're sewing, they're doing cross-stitch, they're doing all kinds of things that, again, we create and collaborate and give them that chance for hands-on applied learning. And we do this all year long for everyone. You'll see up there, there's computer classes, there's so many different kinds of programs, from early literacy to school readiness to working with teens to working with school age groups. And the reason that we do this is for the essential health of our community.
I am Sarah Glagowski. I am the new executive director of the Finger Lakes Library System. What you are looking at right now is our brand new building. We moved in on January 20th of this year. I know some of you have been in our new building. We actually had an open house this past Friday from 3 to 6, where we had well over 100 people come and see our new building. Moving into this space has afforded us to do the things that we should have been doing for our member libraries for many years. We were previously located at the Tompkins County Public Library in a back section. Moving here to 1300 Dryden Road has given us the great space that we needed to start teaching facilities and just helping the member libraries the way we should have been for a number of years. As Annette mentioned, one of the core resources that we provide for the Finger Lakes Library System to our member libraries is the delivery of materials. Every day we have two vans that go out. We serve 33 libraries in 5 different counties. One of the best avenues of cost-sharing sources for this is this delivery of materials. And our county, Tompkins County Libraries, last year handled over 75,000 items for interlibrary loan. As Annette said earlier, anyone in the county libraries can borrow books, especially from anywhere in the United States. This is a very valuable resource and helps stretch the dollars that these member libraries just don't have. And therefore, we have a great community center for these people. The next slide, some of the new things that we are doing is providing some online resources that are really expected from some of the smaller libraries. And quite honestly, the smaller libraries could not do without our help as a system. Our newest one we started this summer is Zinio, which is an e-magazine service. Anyone can download over 100 magazines to their phones, to their iPad, to their desktops. It is similar, in fact, to our OverDrive, our ebook and e-audiobook system, which is also up there. We also provide databases to our member libraries. Again, they would never be able to afford the very costly databases. And these range from, you know, children's encyclopedias to medical knowledge to learning different languages. So we provide a wide variety of databases for them. But we also are beyond e-content. We provide technology support. Again, without our help, some of the smaller libraries would not be able to afford the computers, especially to provide internet access that is so needed for their libraries and their communities. Polaris is the system that we use that is the library catalog, but it's much more than a catalog. It's really how the libraries keep track of their inventory, know who owes what, how many items are in their libraries, all sorts of things. The library system as a whole also should be providing training for all libraries, librarians, trustees, and even volunteers. We also should be the leader for a variety of different programs and to help the member libraries learn about advocacy and to get their message out into the community.
And we really couldn't do it without system support. And a couple of things that Sarah referred to is our internet access and the computer support we get. We also provide Wi-Fi, and that's available in almost all our libraries without a password, because we know that, we are the only way that people can connect, and we will see people pulling into our driveway just for the Wi-Fi access. It's that much in demand. And our interlibrary loan, what I talked about, that we share with each other, we loan almost as much as we borrow. And I think that's really important, because people don't necessarily understand that we are also sharing with Tompkins County Public Library and all the other 33 libraries in the system. It really is the support that we give each other, and we could not do that without the system. And now we're going to move into the challenges we face. And obviously the cost of books continues to go up, but it is also, as Sarah mentioned, the e-books and the e-magazines. It is the computer support. It is the wonderful Polaris. Those fees have gone up, but we, again, couldn't do without the system support, and we expect to pay for that. But in my library, we are seeing a slight decrease in print circulation, but we are seeing a huge leap in electronic circulation, and so our overall circulation continues to grow, and we don't have the continuous growth in our budget to support that. It is a constant struggle to meet that balance for, because readers really use both. Not only are the costs going up, but we also need the people to do it. And we are understaffed and we are underpaid, and there is a lot of library love in this room, and we can't do what we have to do on love, and we are being funded at the level from the county that's just barely above the 1980s level, and we can't continue. And I think that if you look up here, it's sort of amusing, but what we actually do every day borders on social work. We are teachers. We're trainers. We are really doing the work of a healthy community, and we don't have the people to do it in some cases, and we don't have the people with the training, and if we do get people, they're underpaid, they're part-time, and we lose them. I've just lost my second volunteer coordinator, so I feel this. And we also have to train them in all of these technologies, and we don't attract the people who can do this because we are underpaying them. So it is an extremely difficult situation we find ourselves in. So this refers to the minimum wage, and that's because last time we used our OTR request to meet the minimum wage. We had people that weren't even at minimum wage, and now we are embarrassed that we cannot say in this room that we meet Tompkins County's initiative of the living wage. And we are committed to getting there, but we need the funding to do it. And not only do we need to bring up our salaries just for the living wage, but our professional staff, very, very few of us have health insurance, have retirement. It is for all that we do, we are not compensated as we should be. And we enjoy it, but that's not the same as a paycheck. So the current funding, even at the 2% increase, which we are grateful for, does not keep pace with our demands. And what we are finding is that if we are to only continue at that level, we are going to have to make some changes, either cutting programs, reducing hours. We just cannot continue at the way that we are at this time. So our OTR is to move us toward a living wage. It's not really to just increase staff wages, but that is what could happen. For some, it's just hiring enough staff people so that they are not alone in the building. Our board is committed to having two people in the building at all times. Generally, the second person is a volunteer. For safety reasons, you can imagine that this in our libraries, you've seen them, is not ideal, and we are not able, again, to continue without this additional support. So some of us would actually have to hire new people. Some of us can get closer to the living wage, and some of us are so far below that that it's going to be a struggle. So I do want to be sure that you understand that this is only a start for us. And we're only asking for an increase of $2,602 per library. For us in Trumansburg, that would be about a little over a third of what it will take to get us to a living wage. Our board is committed to making that happen. For others, they're thousands away. But we wanted to start somewhere, and we do want you to understand that we are all trying to improve all of our communities wherever our starting point is. To put that into a little bit better perspective, what we're asking for the all of our county funding that we receive from you is about $4 a person for the 41,000 plus people that make up the rural library population. So we hope that you will consider our request and understand that this is a need. We understand that it wasn't recommended in this budget. We are seriously in need of this to continue what we do so well for your communities. Thank you.
Questions? Peter, Mike, and Carol.
Do you have other sources of income? What are your sources of income?
Yes, we do have other sources of income, but we are not all structured in the same way. For example, Trumansburg Library has the tax levy. We have the Tompkins County funding. We have town funding. We have village funding. And we are also an association library, so we are able to raise money through our memberships. And then we have the funding that people expect from libraries. We have a book sale. Our book sale and our fines, which is also a source of income, fund our collection development budget. So most of our public funds in Trumansburg fund all of our personnel. And it is not one source that funds that just to get us to where we are. It takes all of our public funds to do that. Our programs are generally funded by grants. And I can't speak for everyone because you'll see there's wide varying structures. We did bring our budgets if you wanted to see them, but they're, I need to let everybody else answer for themselves. Do you want to talk about your budget sources? Oh, okay. Sure.
There's a switch on there.
I'm Tammy Kubinek. I'm from the Newfield Public Library, and so I have multiple funding sources as well. There's the county funding. We also receive money from the tax levy or from a tax levy. So county tax levy, I just lost my train of thought.
Do you get town or village?
We get town money as well, and so those are our three major funding sources. And as Annette said, our programming money comes from grants. So every time our summer reading program is funded by grant money, we are doing a adult reading program about World War I right now. That money came from the New York Council for the Humanities grant. So we have those three primary funding sources, again, the majority of which pays salary. We also do many fundraising events through the year. We do a book sale as well. We do bake sales. And So we're basically pulling all of the strings together to try to build a beautiful product for our community.
Excuse me one moment. Could you ballpark your budget totally?
Yeah, so I will tell you that Newfield has the smallest budget of all the rural libraries. Our budget this year, it was started around $99,000. We did receive an increase in the school levy, which bumped us up another $4,000. And this year, we actually received for us an enormous donation from a community member of $4,000. So we're looking at next year, with our increase in the levy money, to be at about $103,000. As I said, we received a wonderful donation this year, but we can't expect that next year. So our funding is $103,000. It's what we're looking at. And as I said, we are the smallest library, the smallest budget in among the rural libraries.
Annette, what is yours?
Right. I believe ours is the largest budget in Trumansburg, and we have about a $250,000 budget.
Thank you.
Do you want to hear from the other libraries? I mean, that is the range between the two of us.
5-41 to 42?
I'm sorry?
I think it's in our book, pages 5-41 to 42. Is that each of your budgets?
I don't. Yes. Yes, you do have our total budgets there. Yes.
Peter, it was Mike Ziegler, and then Mike Lane, and then Carol Chalk.
Just two questions. If we asked you for a number on what it would cost to bring everybody up to a living wage, and this legislature said we are going to pay this percent of that, could we get a commitment from the other funding sources to make the difference up? Or is that just not a... Because you were just saying grant money, and that would be hard to do with grant money.
I'll go ahead.
Other players, though, I don't know if they would...
I can speak at least to the people in Shermansburg. So the money that we receive from our levy, of course, we're held at a cap. And so saying that that's going to increase because county funding increases, that's not how the levy works. The town and village do support us, but we... also are showing what we do for their youth and also employing youth, and so they're also in their own struggles, so I would find that they would be unlikely to be committed in that. Our board has made a commitment to bringing us to a living wage. We, again, depending on how much of the funding we get, will depend on whether we'll still be able to have the programs that we are able to normally provide and services and hours and all of those things. So it's not, we don't want to bring up our wages and then have the libraries do less. So it's a very tricky thing. In Shermansburg, I know we are committed to getting there, and we're going to make that happen. If we get the over-target request, then it brings us, like I said, I think it's just a little bit over a third of what we need. So, you know, we're going to put more effort into our association membership. But if you hear, you know, the 103 to the 250, all of us, save one library who isn't represented here tonight, but you have all of their data, are professionals. We all had to get our master's degree. We don't have benefits. You know, we're struggling just to get our part-time people up to a living wage. We want it to happen, but making that kind of commitment, if we knew that we could do that, we would. But I would feel that it's very unlikely, sadly.
Okay. Can I interject something? I'm Diane Pamel from the Southworth Library in Dryden. Actually, I think this moves. That's better. And I do want to just state that every year we get funding from the village of Dryden, from the town of Dryden, and through our endowment funds, which preclude paying any salary. But every year the town and the village have increased what they've given us, as well as the county. So... everyone's working together. I don't know, for living wage, it's going to be a while for us, but it's a bit of a chunk, but each year we try and do a little bit better.
Okay. Can I ask my second question?
Yeah, sure.
Why aren't the town of Ithaca and the city of Ithaca libraries on this list?
We're the rural libraries, and Tompkins County Public Library is
separate.
That's our
library.
Separate.
What about those two libraries?
Yeah, it's a trick question. But I do want to say that we are unique in the state in having an overlapping service area. And I think that you can see where some of this struggle would come in, because there is concern if you're already paying a levy for your taxes in Shermansburg or Lansing or Newfield, then going to pay, you know, if another library was looking at a different funding stream. We are on paper, it looks like we're in competition, but when libraries are helped, they're supporting each other. But dollars that go to Tompkins County don't help rural libraries. They, you know, libraries help each other, but it's we really struggle, and we have people who have never been to Ithaca. That's why the KDT, Kids Discover the Trail program, and we're talking Shermansburg. They come down for the first time sometimes to go to that library. For many people, they know they have the riches of all the library. Your card will work in any library in Tompkins County, and I'm going to speak for Sarah here, but we have a goal that that card will work in any library in the Finger Lakes library system soon. So we don't really want overlapping service areas.
Mike Klein.
First, my annual disclosure that I'm a trustee of the Southworth Library Association in Dryden, just so everyone knows that. Sarah visited your new facility mm-hmm. on Friday. It is wonderful.
Thank you.
And anybody who hasn't had a chance, I'll bet you could get a tour of it. It was really remarkable to visit that. And I want to make the point that I always do every year. Our rural libraries give so much service for such a paltry amount of money that we give to them. And we don't give all five together as much money as it would cost if TCPL had one branch to support. And we learned that when we did a study of the rural libraries a number of years ago. So they work really hard to try to bring these services to the outskirts of the county, and I would hope that we can support these kinds of things.
Thank you. Carol, then Martha.
Yeah, so thank you for providing your budgets. They are in our book, and that was one of the things I was going to point out and find out whether those were your complete budgets, so I got that answer. The living wage, do you have a figure for what the total would be? You said what yours would be, that would only be a third.
Right, but that would be approximately a third for us.
Is
but
that true for the others?
Not at all.
No.
Well, okay, here's the...
Is there a total?
Yes.
It would probably cost about $25,000 a year for Dryden to get up to the living wage.
For the Finger Lakes Library System, it would cost close to $9,000 to get to a living wage.
I'm Susie Guntberg from the Lansing Library, and one thing for the Lansing Library that we discovered when the rural libraries got together to really discuss this issue of the living wage, my board is committed to, within the next few years, trying to get to that living wage, but what we realized is I have one full-time person and two part-time people, and we are working alone in the library a lot, and so I'm very understaffed for the 40 hours that we're open, whereas Dryden might have a lot more staff, but they might pay less. So it does actually take us all about, I think it's a little bit different for you, but it does, for the other rurals, it will take us more like $10,000 or $15,000 to be able to not only pay our staff a living wage, but then staff the libraries that are trying to pay the living wage but are understaffed. So.
And I do want to add that for Chermansburg, the second person is a volunteer. So if you factored that in and we had to actually pay a staff person, then we would also be closer in number to the other libraries. So it's a goal to move us toward that. Our initial request when we were putting the OTR together, we were very excited to see Tompkins County's commitment to a living wage, and we realized that our number was going to be closer to $30,000 as a an additional cost instead of the $3,000 that each library would need. So divided out. So.
Right. And so how did you come to the $14,311 that you asked us for?
Excellent question.
Yeah. We looked at what our funding was at our peak, which, again, wasn't that much, and took a little off that back in, I didn't bring my years, probably 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, we each got $33,500 from the county. So the total request would be $32,500 for each of us should we get the OTR. So it's just kind of piddling us back into what we once were in our days of glory. But that's where we got the number to look at where we were.
Let me remind all of you that Tompkins County 2 years ago did a study on living wage for all of our contract people, including rural libraries, and it would have cost us nearly $3 million to put every contract that we have and everyone that we give money to up to that point. So, frankly, I don't really want to get in a discussion tonight in the weeds about living wage. I understand your request, and I think we can deal with that. Carol, go ahead.
So my other question was going to be for Joe. Given that we have this plan to try to step up, was there a reason that you thought that $14,000 was not a good next step for this particular?
No, it's an answer similar to my other answers, where there comes a point at which the money available to me has been exhausted. So this simply didn't make that cut. I would also remind the legislature, kind of a fine point on our policy. Our policy relates to contractors that we deal with. So when we form a business relationship, we have tried to obligate ourselves to a living wage or get to a living wage. This is a little bit of a different relationship. This is just an underwriting subsidy of the library. So in terms of that direct reference in policy to living wage and what we should try to reach, the rural libraries are in kind of a different class than a contractor that we have entered into a business relationship with.
Namely that they don't have other resources that they can draw down against, like profits.
Well, again, I think you heard that we are one of many sources of funding for the library, so there are other fundings here. And in giving, remember, we began with a 2% increase for all of the agencies. So in terms of making sure that inflation didn't erode our commitment to the libraries that we set, there is that 2% growth factor that's built into their allocations for next year.
Thank you.
Can I add something? I just wanted to say that we focused on the living wage argument because we do have staffing issues and it is a need for us. But for libraries to continue serving Tompkins County, we serve all of Tompkins County. And so there are many, many ways that you've heard us talk tonight about how we're underfunded or only get a small amount of funding from other sources. So we focused on that as one way to just highlight what we need. So I hope that you know that we aren't taking it as that you made a commitment and therefore we want that money. We are committed to improving our libraries in our community and doing that as well. And we appreciate your position, but we really do have a strong need, so we felt we were compelled to come forward with our request in any case. Thank you.
Martha.
Thank you. This is actually, I would like to support the OTR, but I don't think to go beyond that is in the cards here. But I think we... When I think about that your libraries are supported by your town, village, and school district in various flavors of taxpayers, as well as your county tax, but then the town of Ithaca and the city of Ithaca, they pay through their county taxes and that's it. There's a little bit of sales tax that comes from the city. No, there's a little bit of city money into the library, and it's only through the sales tax. It's an allocation through the formula. There's no general fund city money that comes to the Tompkins County Library. So I don't know if this wouldn't help you at all, but it might help in an argument towards getting city or town money towards the larger library. It would really be interesting to see what percentage of your budgets come from county taxes and then town, village, and school and whatever the other. That's maybe a lot of work, but maybe you already have it. And if maybe, and then we compare that to the allocations from city and town for the Tompkins County Library, I would think that would be a shocking kind of revelation for a lot of people. So
we can provide that information. We do have it, and the county funding is not our largest source of funding.
Right.
But we do serve the entire county. So, but we can certainly. Our biggest source of funding is the levy, and then our second biggest is our fundraising as a membership association library.
Mm-hmm.
So, but everybody is different. We don't all have that.
Right. All right. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming down. Next is Youth Services, Chapter 4, page 323, and there are OTRs 70 through 74, and Amy is here.
Thanks. All right. Well, here is the Youth Services budget presentation, and Teresa Albert's here to help out as needed, as always. Usually you're on the right hand, though. All right. So just to begin off our presentation, I always like to remind everyone what the mission of the Youth Services Department is. It's really investing time, resources, and funding into communities to help them enable all youth to thrive. It's really important to go back to that mission for us a lot of times because we don't often work directly with young people. We support the communities that do work with the young people. So on to the pyramid. Just for you, Joe. This is the pyramid of the continuum of youth services. At the bottom of the pyramid is the universal prevention section. It's the recreation partnership. The base of the pyramid are the services that tend to be funded. Where'd it go? Wrong way. More pyramids here. There we go. So at the bottom of the pyramid where we start with recreation, the funding, it's more inexpensive per young person and more can be served. As you move up, it's more expensive and fewer youth are served. So at the bottom is our universal prevention. This is recreation. In the middle, the next step up is the youth development and early intervention. And then as we move up from that, those are our agency services. Those are the things that we actually contract directly with care providers. And at the very top is treatment and placement, and those services are provided by Department of Social Services and Juvenile Justice. So for the Youth Services Department, we really focus on those three bottom tiers. In 2014, just to give you a scope of the youth served through municipalities, these are through our resources along with other resources, there were 7,689 youth served. As we began to prepare the budget looking at 16, there are some major influences that we needed to take into consideration. Our budget is built by our resource allocation team, which is a section of our youth services board. So as they started to begin, they looked at a need to really stabilize our planning and coordination support, looking at how our staff support has been increasing to agencies and municipalities. Some of this is diving into really looking at the metrics that those agencies and municipalities are using to show that the programs and the processes are helping to support young people. And here are two of those different frameworks that we've put in place. I'll talk a little more about them in a few minutes. Other major influences included the end of our Drug-Free Communities grant. It ended last September, which provided us funding to support staff to look at prevention and reduction of underage use of drugs and alcohol by youth. That also, at the same time as we decreased that, there has been increased need cited within the city of Ithaca and the Ithaca City School District for more positive prevention measures. So we've decreased our support to that. At the same time, there has been increased need cited. And in 2016, it will also mark the third year of our three-year funding cycle for those contracted agencies. We have not increased their allocations in those 3 years, and costs have continued to increase for them. Other influences, we really work closely with our municipalities. And so as we've discussed with them, they're seeing fiscal strains. They've been able to fill a lot of the gaps, but after a while, those pressures are placed on them, along with our agencies. Another thing that we played into the building of this budget is as we prepared for the 2016 budget, we began with those projections from the county administrator. As he presented his budget priorities, included in those was this concept of restoring $75,000 of funding to the municipal youth service system. Our recommendations were built on that initial $75,000, and we'll talk a little more about that in a few moments. And again, this request has been unfunded, and we'll see that in the over-target request. So here's another pyramid just to show you how it breaks down for each of these areas. So under recreation, there was nearly a little over 4,000 youth served. Under the municipal youth service systems, about 2,000. And then under our targeted intervention services, about 1,300. And again, you can see as you go up the pyramid, fewer youth are served. However, the services tend to be more costly. And then in total, there was 7,689 youth. As we build the budget, we really look at it in these buckets or categories. So we start with our planning and coordination and our grant services. We also look at rec partnership. However, because my board does not oversee the recreation partnership, We take that back out of the equation, and we'll talk about that in its own presentation in a few moments. We also look at the Municipal Youth Service System and then contracted agencies. So our budget is really built on these three functional areas. So the planning and coordination is really the foundation of the Youth Services Department. That's where we find our six full-time equivalents who serve as liaisons across the youth-serving human resources or human services organizations. So we make sure that the different organizations are connecting across the county. We provide technical assistance and training for youth services providers, for organizations, and we work with all of our municipalities. We have increased our monitoring and changed how we do monitoring, but we monitor program quality not only for our organization but for other organizations as well. We provide research and planning services for youth in Tompkins County, and we are the runaway and homeless youth coordinators for the county, which is a state mandate. And then we have youth employment coordination across the county, and this, again, encompasses grant services such as Safe Harbor and coalition work. Safe Harbor is something that we were selected among a number of communities in New York State to roll out the Safe Harbor program. Safe Harbor deals with child sex trafficking and exploitation. So we're doing some more trainings and really diving into that world here in Tompkins County, and you'll be seeing a lot more in that world in November. I believe that rollout will be complete. So this is what the Youth Services Department staffing does. We really have four functional areas, and so I'm just going to put them up there to give you some framework around what does it look like. It's that coordination piece. It's working directly with all the communities. It's monitoring the data, monitoring the quality of the youth serving programs, and then it's providing training and technical assistance. Often the training and technical assistance builds on that data collection and monitoring. This year we've really focused on three main areas around that. The biggest is the Achieving Youth Results, and you'll see how it encompasses the other two. Achieving Youth Results assesses our county well-being, and it does this through identifying community indicators. We're working with the Results Leadership Group out of Maryland, who has helped us to start setting these community indicators. Once they're set, we start creating an action plan. What does it look like to have healthy youth in Tompkins County? The indicators relate to six goals, and we're having sessions throughout the county asking people about how does this work, what does it look like, what do you need to help raise young people. Moving into Achieving Youth Results is results-based accountability. We brought this into our system over a year ago now, and we're now seeing the metrics. This really looks at the programs that are working in the community, and they define some performance measures, and we're able to look at how those performance measures then relate to the bigger picture. A year in, we've had some great conversations with our contract agencies and have been able to ask some really great questions to help them improve. The final component is the Youth Program Quality Assessment, which is actually one of these performance measures. This has been done with all of our Municipal Youth Service System programs at a certain funding level. We haven't launched it with everyone yet because it is time intensive. It's going into those youth programs and assessing what does it look like in that moment in time. Are they following the features of youth development? We know through research that there's certain things that should be happening there. Is that happening? If not, how do we train the staff and help the staff to make that happen? So this is our roster staff. You'll see there is a slight increase, and we will talk a little bit about that. You'll notice that we do have six FTEs. Currently, there's some shifting there. So with our planning and coordination, there are two over targets. There are other over targets, but I wanted to separate them out by our functional areas. So there's a full-time program management specialist position. This is an interesting piece. If you looked in the budget book, this is a portion of that. We receive grant funding currently for that, and we are requesting other funding from the city, actually, to make that a full-time position. So that's the changes there. The other piece is the use of some rollover funding from previous years to continue our staff development training system, some of the training and technical assistant pieces, as well as the scorecard system that we're using for results-based accountability. So the next functional area is our Municipal Youth Service System, and these are our youth development programs. We have 70-plus volunteers on youth planning groups throughout the county. We have over 2,000 youth served on an annual basis. The major program provider, though not the only program provider, is Cooperative Extension's Rural Youth Services Program. There's a high need of employment skill development and opportunities for first-time youth employment experiences. And we have seen some costs rise in service provision for these programs. So the Municipal Youth Service System, here's just a few pictures. It's a snapshot because every community gets to define their Municipal Youth Service System. They get to define their community needs, their target group. Many work with middle schoolers, though we have some that work in high school and work with elementary students. Some work with the whole school district on certain days, so this is the Trumansburg cleanup day. And then this is one of the Yours and Ours programs, which is a mentoring program. So each program looks different, and the community defines how that program will look for them. In the Municipal Youth Service System, we did request an over-target for the Youth Works Coordinator. This is a program that began 2 years ago now. It attempts to bring some coordination to the Ithaca City School District, except for the city, around youth work. So it works with Enfield, it works for Danby, Enfield, Danby, Caroline, Town of Ithaca, Village of Lansing, Village of Cayuga Heights, and does coordination to make sure that when a young person comes in, they can choose between, if they live in the city, they can work with the Ithaca Youth Bureau Youth Employment Services Program, or they can go to the Youth Works Coordinator. So this would sustain that position. And then this additional over-target request is actually not in our budget. This is the county administrator's original over-target request for the rural youth program or municipal youth service system. And you can see this is what the trending is doing of the municipal youth service system. So beginning in 2009, we were funded at about $335,000, and there's been a consistent decline. This is in the current recommended budget. And then this would be with OTR 14, which is the request that is in the county administrator's budget. The third piece is our contracted agency services. We contract currently with a variety of different providers, eight programs and five different agencies. These are all provided through requests for proposals. They serve on a different variety of different things, from mentoring programs to runaway and homeless programs, and this is just a wordle of the different opportunities. Teen pregnancy is another program that we work with, and family creation with those young parents. As far as the contract agencies, the Resource Allocation Committee did ask for an over-target request to provide an increase because they have not received an increase in the past 3 years of their contract, so they did ask for a 3% increase, which is not recommended. So all of the charts together, you can look and see the recommended budget. There's some slight changes due to some state aid that has been shifted, as well as potential new revenues that we're hoping to bring in from other sources. The OTRs that are supported by the recommended budget are here. And there are three of those. And then the two that are not supported, the first that can be found in our budget for the agency's cost of living, and the second, which is that $75,000 that I discussed previously. And so we'll pause with that. This quote just reminded me of a lot of the people that we work with, and if you haven't heard of Kid President, he does a really great job of being the Kid President, so you should see who he is. And I can take any questions on this first half, and then we can move in direct partnership.
Martha.
Joe, your budget included a 2% increase for agencies, like the Human Services agencies. Right. Are these youth service agencies also, these agency partners in OTR 72 no. included?
The 2% went for the standalone agencies, so those that are just out there. So if there are agencies that are funded or supported within a departmental budget, those did not get the 2% increase.
Okay, you mean...
So Human Services Coalition got the 2%. It's a standalone. You could look at it in your budget. Mm-hmm. It's there. Cooperative Extension... Right. And so forth. But within many of our departments, there are contracts with agencies. DSS has a multitude right. of agency contracts. So we did not increase every one of those contracts by 2%. They did not get the bump.
I see. Okay. Could you explain this $75,000? I'm confused.
I'll try. Should I go first and then Amy can set me straight? So the goal when as you recall, when we had the retreat and we put together the spring projections, it looked like we would have the capacity to do not only a maintenance of effort for our own programs, but also to address some things that we felt needed to be addressed. And we talked about many of those at the front end. And at that time, it looked like we finally had the capacity to drive some dollars back into the rural youth program, the Municipal Youth Services Program. So when the budget was first taking shape, I thought we had the capacity to put another $75,000 in to rebuild, as Amy has said. What happened over the course of the budget, we've talked about that as well. The situation changed. Pensions, at least we thought, were going up when we put the budget together. Sales tax went down. So we didn't have, within the 1.3% levy increase limit that I had, we didn't have enough money to do this. I felt it was still an appropriate policy discussion for the legislature to have. So it's really unusual that I would put something in my own budget and then not fund it. Usually if it goes in, it means that I think it should be funded. In this case, again, within the 1.3% limit I had, I couldn't afford it. But still, I think it's an important discussion for the legislature to have as a part of this budget, and that's why it's in. I put it in to show that it had the support of my office in terms of advancing it to you.
Okay, so is he right, Amy?
He is right.
Okay, and
he's correct.
Joe, where is that? I'm looking for it in your book. Is it not?
Probably
in
under county administration. Kevin, is that where it is?
It is under county administration.
Page.
If I can find it here.
436.
Okay. So now that the pensions actually did go down even more than we expected, so that's something we might want to look at again.
It's right. It's certainly a different circumstance than
I found it.
When I had the budget. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Well.
Thank you, Jim. Amy, you once again win the prize for the most dynamic PowerPoint of all the things. Thank you. Very well done. The distressing part of that, though, is the overall trend starting 2009. And as I recall, about this time last year, there was going to be a special group set up to study the long-term future of your operation. Where does that stand?
Well, we did look at the goal is to look at whether there are whether there's duplication between what happens in our youth services operation and what happens at the city. And so there was some work that was done. Amy and I did spend a fair amount of time. We worked with Kevin Sutherland on that. And in fact, we didn't find many areas of pure duplication that could be eliminated and the cost saved by any kind of a realignment of those two offices. There may be things deeper in the organizations that we should continue to look at, but in terms of finding kind of the trove of things that we thought might save money and result in a realignment between the city and the county youth services, at least at our level, we didn't find it.
That's discouraging news. But thank you.
Anyone else? Go ahead.
All right, so recreation partnership. The recreation partnership budget, you can see here, are the expenditures, revenues, and net local. And this includes the 2% agency increase that Martha was referring to. So this is viewed as a separate agency. This is the recreation partnership registrations. There has been a slight decline in these registrations, as you can see. A lot of this has to do with, even though there have been continual increases, the costs have gone up so much that they've outweighed that, and so they've had to reduce the number of programs offered through the partnership. And a lot of the major influences through the recreation partnership has been the increasing operating costs and the staff salary adjustments. And The over-target request, which is not recommended or not supported in the tentative budget, is for a total of a 3.3% increase to the Intermunicipal Recreation Partnership. The OTR amount you see there, the $821, is actually the 1.3 because they've already received the 2% in addition. And so that's the Recreation Partnership. When the board met, they decided on this 3.3% increase so they could not reduce as many programs had they stayed within the 2% increase. And that's all I have on that one.
Martha and then Dan.
Joe, I was all ready to say, you're trying to fix that reputation that you don't like kids and with that $75,000 that you hung out there and you took back, and now there's $821 you said no to. I'm sorry. I mean, was there any reason here?
Well, yeah, there was a reason. I mean, the agency's got 2%. And so that was that. There was parity across the board in terms of agency funding. So, we understood that they had asked for more money. At the same time, we had said pretty early on that we were going to look for a 2% increase in funding. In some respects, I think we wish that folks would pay heed to that. When we say we're prepared to do the 2%, they might weave that into what they ask for. You can see that they asked for a bit more than that. So it's not a lot of money, but I thought the principle was there's a parity principle that was at work.
Dan.
Amy, the money for the Recreation Partnership needs to be matched by other municipalities. Can you talk a little bit about how that is playing or might play out with the other municipalities?
Right. So if we were to not put that additional funding in, the other municipalities can decide to do two things. And historically, they have done both. At one time, the county did not put in, and the municipalities came in and made that shift. They took that cost on and split it among them. The other thing that could be done is they could all decide not to do that, so there would be a gap there of about $2,400 that then the Ithaca Youth Bureau, who's the Recreation Partnership provider, would have to come back and decide what that would mean and what that would look like. I haven't seen that at this point, but that's what they would need to do.
If we put that money in and the other partners didn't, what happens?
So the other partners at this point have all committed that they will put in the 3.3% at least through their board representatives. So it's not, obviously, their budgets aren't passed at this point, except for the villages. So they'll adjust accordingly.
Thank you.
Mike Klein.
Amy, if these organizations are, if 2% isn't enough for what they want, the 1.3, what kind of raises are they giving their staffs?
So at the Ithaca Youth Bureau and across the city, how many years ago was it now? Probably 4 years ago, they did a salary study, and this should be the last year that we're having those salary adjustments. So there's been some hefty increases in some of those salaries as they looked at them compared to other organizations that they had taken on in that salary study. So I'm not sure exactly how.
I didn't actually get what I thought was an answer. I mean, are they giving 3.3% to their people? They're giving more than that to some of them? Or what's happening?
Yeah. Yes. Some are getting increases, right, beyond that because they have they had a 4 or 5 year plan to bring everyone up to the what they considered the reasonable salary. So some people are getting heftier increases than 3%. Some are not. So it's all based on what their classification is. And I don't know all of the details on that, but I know when they prepare the Recreation Partnership budget, that plays into a big piece of that, is the increasing cost due to the salary study and increasing those salaries.
And it's the city that sets those salaries mostly?
It is. It's all city employees.
All city employees.
Yes. This is through the Ithaca Youth Bureau, all of the programming.
Mike, they're bargained they're bargained salaries.
Yes.
Anyone else? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Up next, the county attorney, and followed by the DA. And the only thing I can say is if the county attorney's budget was $45 million, we gave that budget 10 minutes, So, you know, maybe we'll give him a little bit less than that. But go ahead, John.
My budget is not $45 million.
Yeah, but that's a secret number.
Yeah. Well, when I came in and showed my budget to Joe, he looked at it and he looked up and said, your budget is boring. And it's probably because, I mean, I looked at these numbers, and if you look at the target number and you take, like, the salary and wages and the fringe benefits, the personnel costs, and put it over the total, it's over 96% of it. So basically my entire budget is just personnel and some office supplies. So, you know, with that said, there's really not a whole lot that varies. I mean, we've changed the personnel this year actually for the first time in about a dozen years when Bill Troy came and Steve Flash left on January 1. But the budget is identical. So nothing's really changed, and it's still over 96% of the budget. So, okay. The first slide doesn't really, the only change is the result of fringes in that. The major influence, I think, on the department is basically that we have certain mandated services, which are basically the juvenile delinquency and the PINs. Those we have to do. The remainder of what we do, other than advice to departments, when we do litigation, for example, which we spend a lot of time, personnel matters, the alternative is to hire it out, and the cost of hiring it out is, you know, $200-$300 an hour at least. You know, we are a low-cost alternative for the services that we provide, by far. Like I said, the equivalents and full-time haven't changed at all. So there are two OTR requests, one of which is in your budget and one of which I wrote down. I'll explain a little, and maybe Joe will explain it a little more. The $1,200 is just for computer equipment. We always, in the past, had that in the regular budget. And then when times got tough, we figured we just, in order to trim the budget, we just took it out. So the past 2-3 years, we haven't had any computer replacement, but computers age. So this is just putting back in something that's traditionally been there, but was taken out for a couple years. We bought no computers, I believe, for the last 3 years. But this is just basically restoring as an OTR something that was always there, and we always knew that it would have to come back at some point. We were just trying to save money during the lean years. The legislative OTR, that's the term that Joe uses. I'm not sure I can explain that totally, but it occurred to me that the one thing that we have in our budget, and it's under the professional services, and it's $3,500 in our budget, is really just a pass-through, and that is to pay for the charter and code revisions, which we do every year. We get a bill, they revise it, they keep it up online. And, of course, it depends. It really has nothing to do with the department because it depends entirely on what the legislature does. If the legislature passes 5 local laws, it costs much more than if the legislature passes 1 local law. But as you all know, this year the legislature is going through the charter review. And next year I expect there would probably be some action on that, and I expect there to be significant enough cost in the code which would exceed our current budget because it really doesn't account. And the last time we had a major expense was when we did the redistricting, and that time we scheduled in advance some money to make sure we paid for that as part of the code. So Joe suggested I put that as a legislative OTR, and that is something which will depend, obviously, on what the Charter Committee does, but expect that something will come to the legislature and something will be passed over the course of the year, and it will cost some money to update the charter and code, and that will have to come from someplace. So it runs through my budget, but it doesn't really relate to the county attorney work. And that's, I think, everything I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Will and Martha.
Thank you.
It never occurred to me that when we pass something, there would be costs associated. This is startling information. You mentioned that if we went outside, we'd be paying hourlies of $200 to $300. Have you ever done the math for what our internal costs are? Because I know you guys.
Yeah, I have. I've divided it up and figure out, you know, it depends. Different people have different rates.
Yeah.
But mine is about $50 an hour if you take my salary and divide it by the hours.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's kind of deceptive in the sense that it's sort of a fixed cost because you're
paying
salary anyway. But it's, even if you did it by the hour, it's still much less, about a quarter of what it would be. And, of course, it's a different rate for the paralegals because their salary is different.
Right.
And the
right.
deputy, the salary is different. So it's slightly different for each person. But at most, it's about a quarter of what we would pay if we went out for a
Seems like a great value. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. So the charter revisions, that's probably a one-time expense?
Every 10 years is the idea, yes.
Okay. You mentioned that you do the juvenile justice work.
Right.
If the age of age of majority
criminal responsibility
goes up to 19, in other words, or 18, so 16 and 17 year olds would now be in diversion programs. Would your department's workload go up?
In a theoretical basis, cases which are currently in Gwen's department could end up in my department. That will happen to some extent, I'm sure. It's really hard to put a number on it. So it is possible that this happens, and in the next budget after this happens, we're going to see an effect, and maybe we would need. And, of course, it could be a diminution in what they do, so it could be not an increase in overall expense but a shifting of expenses. But I think everybody thinks, why don't we wait for that bridge and cross it when we get to it rather than trying to guess.
Right. No, I understand. That makes sense. But we've been following probation and watching costs, or, you know, thinking about the cost there. So it just says to me that maybe we want to make sure, if the state does change the law next session, we should really just kind of check in with you, too, and watch what happens.
Right, and how it's going to affect. It's not just Gwen's department and mine. It's also probation,
right.
Social services, because it'll have an effect on several departments. And we'll really have to look at it closely. It certainly won't be a decrease for work for us. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And a late entry is the district attorney, Gwen Wilkinson, who was moved from the last meeting to this meeting. She'd been waiting patiently. She went and got the oil change in her car and did her laundry.
No, I'm thanking you for your patience and forbearance. This happens every year I get scheduled, and every year I have to reschedule. So once again, thank you for being flexible. I don't mind waiting at all.
Okay. Well, we're glad you're here.
Okay. So, Kevin, is this the... Okay. It's been a long day. This is pretty straightforward. And, of course, I'll be happy to take your questions. I have one OTR. It's for a part-time investigator to be added to the roster in order to deal with our major influence. There are many major influences out there imminent, but this is here now. We are now going to be dealing with a body camera protocol for IPD cases and sheriff's cases. Every single case is going to be handled by police officers wearing cameras which are on from the beginning till the end of every single call for service. For all arrests, whether they be for violation level offenses, misdemeanor crimes, or felony crimes, there will be a vastly expanded universe of evidence that will have to be reviewed, analyzed, evaluated for probative value, materiality, and most importantly for Brady and Giglio concerns, which for those of you who do not live in the law and order world means exculpatory evidence or evidence that can be used for impeachment. This is going to create significantly more work per case and at every stage of the criminal case. And the four main stages of a case, of a felony case, are listed at the bottom of the page there. This is going to be an unprecedented expansion of time and material in criminal cases. We don't yet know how it's going to play out because we've never had anything like this before. My thought in adding a part-time criminal investigator was that it was the most economically conservative way to put somebody in place to help us analyze evidence, perform any follow-up functions that may arise, any needs that may arise as the result of having more evidence to look at in order to prep for trial and hearings. Will it be enough? I don't know. I may be back here at some point and say that I was too conservative in my approach to this. But I believe that this is a legitimate first start and that it hopefully will get us through 2016. Now, let me go back. I don't know if you have any questions about this slide. We can address them. There's really not too much to say about the expenditures and revenues. They've remained pretty much the same. The state's giving a little more money for my salary. Our other revenue streams are the same. Full-time equivalents will be increased by the amount of the part-time investigator. That's the only change there. And the over-target request that I've just described to you is $41,077. It is supported by the recommended budget. So, questions?
Questions for Gwen. Peter Stein.
If I understood you right, you said it would be a significant amount of money to decide what you have to give to the defense with the body cameras. So why don't you give the whole thing to the defense?
You said a significant amount of money?
Did I misunderstand?
Let me tell you what I said, and maybe I misspoke. All of the evidence has to be reviewed and analyzed to determine its relevance to the case, its impact to the case, whether it goes to an issue that's material in the case. And then I added on the end and emphasized the Brady and Giglio components, which is exculpatory evidence and material for impeachment, because that has been the focus of intense attention across the state and across the nation with respect to prosecutors' offices. And it's something that my office takes very seriously indeed. And so with more evidence, we're going to have more potential exculpatory evidence. We do engage in open file discovery, but that does not mean we don't still have to look at every single piece of it. And every single piece now, there's going to be many, many, many more pieces. So that's what I was trying to say.
So it isn't enough just to take the evidence and give it to the defense attorney and say, do what you want with it.
Well, the evidence will be given to the defense attorney in the course of discovery, but it still has to be looked at. I'm not going to have evidence in a case that I'm prosecuting and not have had somebody seen and analyze every bit of it.
Okay.
Will.
So, this, once again, we're learning that something is endlessly more complex than we probably anticipated. The Public Safety Committee is just now still considering the policies surrounding body cameras. Am I right in assuming that there would be potential other uses beyond your office and a criminal defense trial, but other uses of these videos that the public may have some mechanism of obtaining them? Would that all go through this person in your office, or would there have to be yet somebody else to make the decisions about the appropriateness of releasing that?
My office would deal with this material only in the context of specific criminal cases. If there's somebody out doing a study on, say, the use of body cameras in Tompkins County, and they want to go through 200 cases worth of video in order to ascertain how many extraneous people are portrayed on camera, say, for some reason. That would have nothing to do with my office.
Or what if a citizens group felt that the local law enforcement had acted inappropriately and the video came into play as a piece of evidence?
That would go through the law enforcement agency.
Okay, so you're going to have multiple decision makers in terms of release of these videos?
Yes, depending on the purpose for which release is sought, that is correct.
Okay, and who's the final arbiter on all that?
There's no one arbiter. For example, let's take the city of Ithaca and Ithaca PD because I think they're closest to rollout. The city attorney for complaints against an Ithaca police personnel, the city and a lawsuit, the city attorney would defend that lawsuit. So the request for discovery, specifically the videotape footage, would go to the city attorney's office. The city attorney and ultimately a judge would be the final arbiter of that. In discovery, I guess for the prosecution side, I am the final arbiter. And if there is an argument about what should be turned over, it ends up in court before the county court judge. We make our arguments, and then the judge is the final arbiter in the confines of a criminal case. So you are correct. There could be multiple areas, but those multiple areas are not presided over by one person in one office.
Okay.
Okay.
Anyone else?
It sounds complex. Thank you.
It is complex.
Anyone else? Thank you, Gwen.
You're very welcome.
EBC Group, we are back here Thursday. We have assigned counsel, cooperative extension, transportation facilities, TCAT, emergency response, the History Center.
Is it Wednesday?
Or Wednesday, whatever. You come Thursday, nobody will be here. Or I'll come Thursday, you can come Wednesday. County Administrator and Capital B last.
Right, Wednesday? It is Wednesday, right?
Yeah, Wednesday. It is Wednesday. Sorry. I make mistake.